This is Guns and Butter. There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear.
There's a man with a gun over there. Ford essentially sponsors the careers of so many of the principal operatives of this invisible government down to our own time. Look at the names we've just mentioned. Cheney is the White House Chief of Staff. Rumsfeld is the Secretary of Defense. Alan Greenspan, who has run the economic side of U.S. life for 15 years or so until, you know, just a few months ago, is at the Council of Economic Advisors. George Bush is in there. Bremer, who destroyed Iraq, is on Kissinger's staff. And you can make a very long list. The main heavies of the invisible government that we've plagued with until the present time get their big moment, their big chance to, you know, make the big career leap under Gerald R. Ford.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Webster Tarpley. Today's show, the Ford presidency. Webster Tarpley is an author, historian, investigative journalist, and lecturer. In 1992, he co-authored George Bush, the Unauthorized Biography, which still stands as the only comprehensive and critical account of the former president and his family network. Posted for free on the Internet since October 1996 at www.tarpley.net, this study has become an underground classic. Tarpley is also author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, Surviving the Cataclysm, A Study of the World Financial Crisis, and Against Oligarchy, a collection of essays and speeches from the years 1970 to 1996. Webster Tarpley, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. Happy New Year.
Good to have you, Webster. Happy New Year to you. Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States from 1974 to 1976, died December 26th and is widely being hailed as a national healer, that he woke us from our long national nightmare. Was Gerald Ford a healer?
Well, let me say, first of all, I don't like piling on the deceased, but if there's an overwhelming political reason, which I think there is in this case, we have to tell it as it actually was, and the historical truth is more important than the amenities of not kicking a departed individual. I would say the real message of the Ford administration is he had proclaimed the Constitution works. I would say the lesson is the Constitution does not work. And when he said our long national nightmare is over, I would say no, it was just beginning. In other words, his presidency marked a qualitative increase in the power of a force I call the invisible government. The term is not new with me. It's been kicking around since the 1950s and 1960s. What I mean by it is the idea that the government of the United States is dominated on many issues much of the time from behind the scenes by what amounts to a clique of bankers, a banker's cabal, mainly embracing Wall Street, the City of London, the financier faction. You can call them the Anglo-American financier faction. They've been around for a good 400 years. Their crimes are legion. And it is this invisible government to which Gerald Ford was a servant, not to the Constitution or anything like that. He was a devoted follower, servant, and errand boy, indeed, for this entity, this corrupt financier entity, which has helped to destroy the country. The living standard in the United States has declined by two-thirds since the moment he said the long national nightmare is over. Now, he was, of course, a person of very limited mental capability. Lyndon B. Johnson, who had known him, you know, very closely because Johnson had been in the Senate at the same time that Ford had been in the House of Representatives, said this man is so dumb that he can't walk and chew gum at the same time. He's evidently played football too long with no helmet. Another good one is William Loeb, the reactionary extreme right-wing curmudgeon who ran the Manchester Union Leader and was so important in so many primary campaigns for so long, he would coin names for people as they came into the state. And for Ford, it was Jerry the Jerk. So he's somebody of extremely modest capabilities. But the administration that he led was a turning point in the increased power of this financier cabal over the United States. And this, of course, it's something that builds up to 9/11, that looks back to the Kennedy assassination and a whole series of other things that we can't get into. But maybe to start from the Kennedy assassination, I would say this is the moment when Gerald R. Ford somehow emerges from the pack of Midwestern Republican congressmen or other elected officials, Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania or Rhodes of Ohio or Dirksen of Illinois, all of them more famous than him. He is chosen in 1964 to be a member of the Warren Commission to investigate the Kennedy assassination. And Gerald Ford now dying this past December is the last surviving member of that Warren cover-up commission, even though Senator Arlen Specter was the principal lawyer for the commission. It is he who invented the lunatic theory of the magic bullet, that one bullet can cause seven wounds and then still be found on a stretcher in relatively pristine condition at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. I would say that what Ford did on the Warren Commission was largely to play the role of filler, of a supernumerary, right? Somebody who was going to raise his hand and approve whatever the more powerful members of the commission wanted. And that essentially meant two people, I would say, not so much Warren, former governor of California, former chief justice of the Supreme Court, but Alan Dulles is the person who really ran this. And Alan Dulles, of course, these are the fascist pro-Hitler Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State for Eisenhower, Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA for all those years. And it's Alan Dulles who superintended a cover-up. And we know, of course, from Joan Mellon's writings that if there's a matrix or a locus where the Kennedy assassination was planned and carried out, it's the CIA Operations Directorate. And she's shown this in I think, exhaustive detail in one of her recent books. So Alan Dulles is there to steer the commission away from actually showing that Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent for CIA, FBI, and the U.S. Customs, and into the fields of the magic bullet. The other guy in that commission who merits mention, John J. McCloy, extremely powerful member of the Eastern establishment, indeed for some period of time in the 50s, 40s, and maybe into the 60s, the spokesman, the person who articulated in public the views of this banker's clique. And he would take his place with people like, Andrew Mellon, Colonel Stimson, later McGeorge Bundy, George Shultz, James Baker in our own time. We have a little bit of a difference of opinion in the ruling elite right now. But this is how Gerald Ford got their attention, because he was simply willing to vote up the most absurd lunatic theories, the magic bullet and the lone assassin theory, the entire Kennedy assassination cover-up. So that then brings us to a little bit beyond this, Watergate, something that starts, as we know, in 1972.
Before we speak about Watergate, I did want to ask you, do you know specifically who chose Gerald Ford for the commission, and how did they know how he would operate there?
No, I haven't really gone into the details of that. I mean, obviously, you'd have to, Earl Warren would have an important role in it, and I think some of them were chosen in conference with President Johnson, because it was a commission that he created. So, again, Johnson wants to get a commission to investigate the Kennedy assassination, and he chooses a man whom he has already described as so dumb that he couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. So not too much zeal for truth.
Well, Webster, we were going to move on to Watergate, and as we do, I wanted to ask you, how and why was Gerald Ford selected to be Nixon's new vice president after Spiro Agnew resigned? Could you talk a little bit briefly about what happened to Agnew?
Well, the general context of this is Watergate is a coup d'etat. Watergate is not what you think. Watergate is not two crusading journalists, Woodward and Bernstein, working for the lovable curmudgeon Ben Bradley of the Washington Post and fighting the establishment and scooping the New York Times and doing all this crazy stuff. Watergate is a coup d'etat. It's quite evil, as you can see from the results, brought about by the same bankers clique with the help of CIA, FBI, Henry Kissinger, and the rest. And Gerald Ford is essentially a bit player, a walk-on part in this. And it reminds us that, you know, simply being president of the United States doesn't really indicate very much that you have special power. You can easily be a puppet, as indeed he was, a puppet of Kissinger, above all, for the most of the time he was in office. Basically, the idea was that at a certain point, you have this move by the banking establishment to change the character of the presidency. And with the why of Watergate, we can go through a number of things before we get to this. One reason that Nixon was brought down was because Nixon had liquidated the Bretton Woods system, the only monetary system the world had, and indeed the most successful monetary system in the history of the world, which had been wantonly destroyed by Nixon on August 15th, 1971. It's a date that I would stress. It is the turning point in all of our lives. Anybody who's lived back to that time should mark that as the time when things go from improvement and progress towards pessimism, decline of the labor movement, decline of living standards, and so forth. It's intimately bound up with the fact that the monetary system was junked by Nixon and his advisors, Connolly, Greenspan, and a bunch of others, Arthur Burns at the Federal Reserve. The Bretton Woods system had allowed the reconstruction of the world after World War II. It was essentially the Roosevelt New Deal for the world. It's the greatest achievement of Franklin D. Roosevelt's administrations in a certain sense, because it made possible the highest rates of economic growth the world has ever seen. The problem, of course, was that the U.S. Was not exporting enough, and therefore there was no demand for dollars, so people kept coming to the U.S. to get gold from Fort Knox, and it was on August 15, 1971, the British, as usual, who come in and destroy the system by demanding several billion dollars worth of gold stocks, which would have started a run on the dollar. So Nixon is the guy who carries this out. I would just point out that having lived through this in pretty much inactive political life, it's worth noting that every government in the world, more or less, except the Soviets, the Chinese, the North Vietnamese, and the communist world, every capitalist government in Europe, certainly, in Japan, and in North America, Canada, all of these governments fell as a result of this huge change. And the idea is, it's a small clique of financiers who want to carry this out, but the backlash that it creates is huge, because it means that the entire economy goes on a downward path. Remember also that Nixon had decreed wage and price controls. He had decreed phase one, phase two, phase three. This created a tremendous amount of friction that led to a general desire to somehow do something against Nixon. That would be number one. Second point on Nixon would be the Vietnam War, which was, of course, being prolonged by Nixon and Kissinger in a way that was excruciating for people who lived through it at the time. And also, of course, they were losing, right? The January 1973 Paris Peace Accord, so-called, is essentially the defeat of the United States and the departure of the U.S. from that region. You've also got an energy crisis going on, right? You've got this fake oil crisis of 1973-74 that Nixon does nothing to fight to stop. It's essentially a cabal of the cartel, the oil cartel, the Seven Sisters, the Anglo-American oil companies, meeting at the, I guess this one is the Bilderberger meeting in Saltsjöbaden, Sweden, in the spring of 1973, and saying, well, we're going to have a 400% increase in the price of oil. This is designed to try to shore up the dollar by creating artificial demand for the dollar. Otherwise, the dollar might have ceased to be this international currency that it's been able to remain over the past 30 years. But all of this stuff causes tremendous frictions. There's also the fact that Nixon is widely hated. He's a paranoid personality. He's abrasive. He tends to isolate himself, right? The word about the Nixon White House was you have the Chinese Wall of Haldeman and Ehrlichman, you have the Imperial Presidency, you have the White House Palace Guard. People can't get through to talk to Nixon. He's a recluse. He's secretive. This generates tremendous resentment and suspicion in the minds of the oligarchy. So there's also a lot of hatred against Nixon left over from the McCarthyite period, the Helen Gehagan Douglas and all the other things that Nixon had championed, all of his red baiting and totalitarianism that he was pushing under the aegis of Senator Joe McCarthy and the witch hunt against communists here, there, and everywhere, Alger Hiss, and so forth. Right? Some of these names don't mean a lot to people today, but these were immensely charged issues at the time. So Nixon was widely hated.
I'm speaking with author and historian Webster Tarpley. Today's show, The Ford Presidency. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Finally, I would say most fundamental is that the finance oligarchs have just had two presidents. They've had Kennedy, who tried very hard to reassert the powers of the presidency as they had been exercised by Franklin D. Roosevelt. Generally speaking, the only president after Lincoln who really exercises the power of the presidency, who you can really say is president of the United States, is Roosevelt, but Franklin. But then Kennedy attempts to return to these methods. And, of course, the oligarchy at that point says, well, we'll never allow another real president of the United States. We are an oligarchy. We are the rule of the few, the bankers, and we do not accept the idea that there can be a constitutional president who's more powerful than we are. And that's what Roosevelt was, and this is what they're permanently organized to stop. Even today, a lot of what they do is dictated by precisely these considerations, right? Why they prefer such weak puppet presidents, as the current one, people who can't think. And so on down the line, can't resist what the bankers might want. However, they'd seen Kennedy try to assert the presidency, therefore he had to be liquidated, and Johnson. Johnson was, on the whole, more powerful than they wanted also, although he was mentally much weaker than Kennedy. You can read about Johnson in Doris Kearns' book, LBJ and the American Dream. He had a whole series of complexes that they were able to play on, right? His feelings of social inferiority and intellectual inferiority, and Doris Kearns writes all about this stuff. But nevertheless, the fact that Johnson had been so powerful as the majority leader of the Senate, in a Democratic Senate, and then moving on to become the president, this gave him a certain amount of control over the legislative and executive branches that was too much. So Johnson had to be ushered out. And then you get this period of Nixon. And Nixon, with his paranoia, seems to excite fears that there's going to be another imperial presidency. Probably more appearance than reality behind that. But at this point, the oligarchy basically says, let us take this moment where there's so much discontent about the Vietnam War, about the Bretton Woods system collapsing, about the energy crisis, about the social breakdown, a whole series of other things, right? The counterculture had created a tremendous backlash, right? The prevalence of narcotics and all the rest of this. They say, let us make Nixon into a terrible example. Let us destroy him and let us use that to permanently weaken not just the presidency, because they wanted to weaken the presidency, but let's weaken the Congress, too. Let's subject the congressional committee system to a watergating process, which we can then use to assert more and more financier control over the government. Because I think you can see this aspect in Watergate as it plays out over just a few more years, perhaps, than the mid-70s. So this is what they do. And the idea with it is something like this. It starts with leaks. We just had some leaks, right? You saw the leak of the Maliki Memorandum, the leak of Rumsfeld's farewell snowflake. Whenever you have leaks, you have to wonder what's going on. Is the overthrow of the president going to be prepared? In the case of Nixon, the leak is the leak of the Pentagon Papers in the summer of 1971, I guess it is, which is essentially a bunch of secrets that are not secrets. Anybody who had been reading Le Monde or any competent European paper knew all this stuff. There was nothing in the Pentagon Papers that was really new. But it was an occasion when the Pentagon Papers were leaked and the New York Times published them and the Boston Globe and the Washington Post and the whole establishment came out to support the leaking of these papers by Daniel Ellsberg, a nuclear targeting planner of the RAND Corporation. Not an innocent babe, I'm sure, but rather somebody playing an assigned part. At this point, Kissinger is able to go to Nixon and play on his paranoia, saying to him something like, Mr. President, these leaks are killing us. We can't have a competent government if we've got the leaks of all of these important documents. And there was not just the Pentagon Papers, but also a crisis between India and Pakistan in those same years, the so-called tilt crisis, where Nixon wanted to support Pakistan as part of the China card, but much of the State Department was actually supporting India. And there were leaks in there. There was stuff with Jack Anderson and so forth, right? Source Eggnog, now known as Brit Hume of Fox News, comes out of all this. So what happens is Kissinger goes to Nixon. He says, look, there are all these leaks. We've got to do something about it. We've got to create a special secret police in the White House to fight the leaks. These are the plumbers. Who gets to be a member of the plumbers? Well, the most notorious CIA covert operative of the Cold War, Howard Hunt, the guy who, you know, overthrew the government of Guatemala and committed God knows what other crimes, attempts to kill Castro, possible role in the Kennedy assassination, and so forth and so on. And Gordon Liddy, a member of the FBI, who's got Nazi sympathies, he's got, you know, all kinds of, you know, Germanic race theories going through his head and so forth, and a group of others. So that's the group that is created. And, of course, they go and run wild. They go and break into the Watergate building, the offices of the Democratic National Committee, not once, not twice, but three times, four times, until they get caught. Because the goal is to get caught and then implicate Nixon in a cover-up. And that's pretty much how it goes. From then on, you get people revealing in the course of hearings that there's a secret White House taping system, the Butterfield revelations. You've got John Dean, another person playing an assigned role, I think. Again, not a fighter for democracy and the purity of the Constitution, but somebody who's working for the powers that be. And the powers that be, of course, are not Nixon, but Wall Street, London, people like this. Ellsberg, Dean, all playing their roles. And, of course, Nixon playing his role, too, and manipulated in this paranoia. And the interesting one is, the smoking gun tape, the tape which, when revealed in August of 1974, forces Nixon to resign almost immediately. The idea there is that he says there's a group of Texans that have been funneling money illegally to the committee to reelect the president. And he says, well, those Texans will have to testify so and so and so and this, that, and the other thing, and we'll tell the FBI that it's a CIA operation and we'll shut them down this way. The interesting thing here is that the group of Texans that he's referring to includes George H.W. Bush, Bush the elder, Bush the 41st president of the United States. So that is what brings down Nixon. So the idea is it's a complicated process of coup d'etat that takes a couple of years. If Nixon had been smarter, he could have fought back. Now, the relevance of all this to Gerald Ford is simply this. When they talk about the pardon that Ford gave Nixon, right, but people remember, you know, the television is reminding us, oh, Ford was a great guy. He wanted to heal the country. Let's put an end to all of this divisive contention, and let's not drag poor Nixon with phlebitis in front of the magistrates and, you know, have him in the prisoner's dock. You know, he has suffered enough. And then poor Pat and all the rest of this. This is, of course, a lot of malarkey. The issue is that if Nixon had been put with his back to the wall and had to mount a legal defense, the legal defense would most likely have included the fact that there had been a conspiracy to have a coup d'etat against the elected president of the United States, because that is what had happened, quite independent of, you know, the obvious animus that everybody has against Nixon as a villain and all the rest of it, which I share. But you got to have the clarity of seeing that the main issue is that Nixon is being overthrown by this group. If you look in a book called Body of Secrets by Jim Haugen, you'll see that he points out there's a guy in New York City called Woolston Smith, who's a New Zealander, pretty much a British agent, who gives briefings in advance in June of 1972. In the first days of June 1972, he basically goes through a scenario for people saying, hey, there's going to be a bunch of break-ins into the Watergate buildings, and this is going to lead to a crisis that's going to overthrow Nixon. So this is what Ford is essentially doing. He's playing his part in that. So Ford is told by Nelson Rockefeller, the personification of this CIA Rockefeller Mellon Morgan faction that runs much of the country, not all, but a lot, give him a pardon. Give him a pardon. And, of course, he says, yes, sir, and he writes out the pardon, even though with this he's essentially destroying his own political future.
How was Gerald Ford chosen to succeed Spiro Agnew as Nixon's vice president?
It's a conference of various people in the Congress, because under the relevant amendment of the Constitution, he had to be approved by the Congress. And the idea was that he was well-known to the House, well-known to the Senate, and he was acceptable to all of them. He was sort of the one. There were no blackballs. There were no vetoes against him. So he, at this level, he was acceptable to the legislative leaders, and of course he was acceptable to the invisible government, because he had proven that he was a pliable puppet in the course of the Kennedy cover-up, right, to the Warren Commission.
I'm speaking with author and historian Webster Tarpley. Today's show, The Ford Presidency. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now we get to another interesting one. When Ford becomes president, right, Nixon departs, right? Nixon leaves. It's August of 1974. The vice presidency becomes vacant. Now, I urge you to a lot of what I'm talking about comes, let me just make a parenthesis. I spent 10 days in 1991 at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Very interesting place, full of stuff about George Bush, the elder, which was what I was looking for there, right? I was researching my book, George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, and I have a chapter in this called Bush Attempts the Vice Presidency. What happened was, when Ford moved up, Nixon departed, Ford moved up, the vice presidency was vacant. There was then a second round of picking a new vice president, because Agnew had been forced out, Ford had been put in. Ford moves up, got to get a new vice president. So at this point, there's a contest. Originally, it's three ways. First of all, it's Nelson Rockefeller for the financiers and the liberal Republicans. Barry Goldwater is the favorite son of the reactionary Republicans and the overt warmongers and the wild men, so to speak. And George Bush the elder is the third candidate. And very early on, Goldwater drops out in favor of Bush the elder, and it gets to be a fight between Nelson Rockefeller and George Bush to see who's going to be the vice president. So from the point of view of the banking community, this is great, because you've essentially got Chase Manhattan Bank with Rockefeller and Standard Oil competing against Brown Brothers Harriman in the person of Bush the elder. So it's also interesting to see, if you look in that little chapter, you can see who are the people who wanted Bush to get the vice presidency. Very, very interesting array. Anyway, finally, Ford chooses Nelson Rockefeller, who had been, you know, governor of New York, presidential candidate, famous leader of the financier Republicans, right? Liberal Republican means financier. Liberal means financier, pretty much, in my book. So here's the problem that this poses for Ford. In 1974, he lets Nelson in. In 1975, in a period of 1 month, there are two attempts to assassinate poor Gerry Ford, showing how expendable he is. We get Sarah Jane Moore and Lynette Squeaky Fromm. And I believe one or more of these takes place in California, in San Francisco. And the news reports are full of the fact, you know, the bullet holes are still in front of, still visible in the front of the hotel where this all happened. The problem with this is, though, you have two attempts to assassinate the president of the United States in 1 month. Now, the usual theory, of course, is, oh, it's just another one of those lone assassins. But what happens when you have two lone assassins? Isn't that somehow a contradiction in terms? I mean, if you had three lone assassins, would they still be lone assassins? Looks to me like once you get two, it's not lone assassins anymore. It's a product. It's a pattern which points to a conspiracy. Maybe this is just an occupational hazard that I have. So he gets these pot shots taken at him. And it probably has something to do with the fact that he's preparing to reshuffle his administration, and also fairly soon to tell Nelson Rockefeller that he doesn't want Nelson on the ticket for 1976. He's going to get rid of Nelson Rockefeller, and he's going to bring in Bob Dole, who's much more acceptable to the right-wing Republicans that are now more and more dominating the party, right? The liberal financier Republicans, of course, being in a period of decline, and Nelson Rockefeller widely hated, and deservedly so, because of what he represented. The Halloween Massacre by Ford, so-called, was Halloween, October 31st, 1975. He deprived Kissinger of his two hats, right? Kissinger had been Secretary of State and the head of the National Security Council. On that Halloween, Gerald Ford said, no, no, Henry, you're going to have to be content with Secretary of State. I'm bringing in Brent Scowcroft, later Kissinger's business partner, to be the NSC director. He ousts James Rodney Schlesinger, Rodney the Robot, a kind of Dr. Strangelove of nuclear warfare game theory. He is ousted from the Pentagon. Donald Rumsfeld becomes the Secretary of Defense. All this time, Dick Cheney is the chief of staff for Ford in the White House. We also get Colby ousted from the CIA, and George Bush the Elder is brought back from China to be the head of the CIA. Interesting. The reason that Bush the Elder couldn't get the vice presidency in 1974 was that he was so dirty as a result of his involvement up to his neck in one of Nixon's illegal political slush funds, illegal money funds, the Townhouse Fund. So what they had to do for Bush the Elder was to find him a job that did not require Senate confirmation, and it was the representative in Beijing. So George Bush the Elder essentially became Henry Kissinger's secretary, steward, running dog, if you will, in Beijing for the year 1975, and then they bring him back to be the head of the CIA, and at that point things have calmed down a little bit. If you read in my book about those hearings, Gary Hart and some others do ask him, you know, how about these, you know, how about the money laundering? They essentially show that they know that Bush is in the smoking gun tape and that there's been, you know, slush funds going on, but they say, well, what the heck, we'll let him in, as long as Ford promises that he won't make Bush the vice presidential candidate, because it would be improper, they say, to have the CIA director be involved in partisan politics. It might lead to a contradiction, a conflict of interest. Having mentioned all these names, you see what Ford does. Ford essentially sponsors the careers of so many of the principal operatives of this invisible government down to our own time. Look at the names we've just mentioned. Cheney is the White House Chief of Staff. Rumsfeld is the Secretary of Defense. Alan Greenspan, who has run the economic side of U.S. life for 15 years or so until, you know, just a few months ago, is at the Council of Economic Advisors. George Bush is in there. Bremer, who destroyed Iraq, is on Kissinger's staff. And you can make a very long list. The main heavies of the invisible government that we're plagued with until the present time get their big moment, their big chance to, you know, make the big career leap under Gerald R. Ford.
Yes, I noticed when I saw the pictures in the newspaper of Gerald Ford's memorial service and the people attending, it was all the same people that were in his administration that are in the administration now.
It's essentially a permanent bureaucracy. It's a revolving door, right? Every time a Republican gets reelected, these same discredited, failed bureaucrats come back. But let's see how Ford was essentially gotten rid of. Now we're in 1976. Times have changed. The demands of the finance oligarchs are even greater than they were in 1974 and 1975, because it's a tremendous world crisis going on in the background. Remember, the dollar is in danger of losing its status as the principal currency. The Vietnam War has been lost, right? We've had the fall of Saigon to the North Vietnamese right in the middle of Ford. We've got all of this, you know, huge upheaval going on. At this point, The banking community says, why don't we get rid of Ford? Let's bring in somebody else who's even more pliable and more adventurous, right? Somebody who's got more, brinksmanship, somebody who's going to take greater risks. So they find this obscure governor, Jimmy Carter, who has already had at least one nervous breakdown. This is what Carter describes as his born-again experience. But in one of his earlier runs for governor of Georgia, he had lost the election, had a nervous breakdown after that, called that his born-again experience, and was therefore then acceptable to the establishment. Right? They like to have people who've got a certain history of psychological problems. For example, for Gerald R. Ford, it's that he's an orphan, right? He's separated from his original parents at a very early age. And to the banking community, that is a sign that somebody's sense of identity may be weaker. In the case of Carter, it's that he's had this nervous breakdown. So we have, in the spring of 1976, I guess it is, or late 75, a meeting of the Trilateral Commission in Kyoto, Japan, where Jimmy Carter, governor of Georgia, little known, is introduced by Gianni Agnelli of Fiat, the Italian automobile company, to this group of international bankers and globalists, saying, ladies and gentlemen, here's the next president of the United States. It's going to be Jimmy Carter. Why do they want him? Because Carter is willing to do two things. He's willing to turn the government of the United States over to two individuals. One is Volcker, who is going to take over the Federal Reserve. He's going to raise interest rates to 22%, the highest since Jesus Christ, as Helmut Schmidt of Germany pointed out. And he's also going to turn foreign policy over to Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is a dangerous adventurer against the Soviets. And he remains that to this day. He's a Polish petty nobleman with British intelligence background through Canada, who's got this tremendous animus against the Soviets. And they feel that they want to do something ambitious in order to redress the fact that the U.S. is so obviously defeated in Saigon in 1975. They're thinking about, you know, going on to a confrontation track against the Soviets and having a confrontation cabinet chosen by Carter. And Brzezinski would be the key guy at the National Security Council. So we get to the 1976 election, and I lived through this. The interesting thing about the 1976 election is Ford won the election. Ford won. Carter was defeated. The reason that Ford was not able to have a second term was that Carter, the machine supporting Carter, carried out massive vote fraud in New York City, New York State in general, and in Ohio. If you go back, a Republican Party official, Fioravante Perotta in Manhattan, on the night of the election, went to court to get the voting machines seized as a prelude to trying to figure out, you know, how this vote fraud had come about. And in Ohio, the same thing. On the morning of Election Day, Walter Mondale, the candidate for vice president with Carter, said, "Vote early, vote often." And that's exactly what they did. They bust people back and forth between Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana. There's some people voted in all three states and so forth. And it was simply, it was a massive vote fraud. It was so massive that it became obvious to Ford in the White House that he had been the victim of vote fraud. Now the question is, what's he going to do? At this point, we have to remember that he has the pathetic figure of Betty Ford, who by this time is she's an alcoholic, she's a substance abuser, right? She's later going to go on to this, you know, meritorious humanitarian project of founding the Betty Ford Clinic to try to help people who have these problems, which are common in society. But the problem is, when you get to the apex of power and you've got these weaknesses, you can then be played on. It becomes a vulnerability. The vulnerability was exploited by a person we haven't mentioned yet. We've mentioned that Nelson Rockefeller is the vice president in the White House with Ford, representing CIA, Rockefeller, Chase Manhattan Bank, the oil cartel, you name it. But Rockefeller's second wife now, Happy Rockefeller, is the operative. Happy Rockefeller goes to Betty Ford and reasons with her that the presidency is not worth it, that she really doesn't enjoy the life in the White House. There's too much stress, too much pressure. It's obviously causing a terrible toll on her. And essentially, Happy convinces Betty that if Jerry fights the vote fraud, he'll be throwing his legacy away. The reasoning is, Jerry's legacy is that he healed the country after Watergate and brought us back to calm political life. But if you go out and fight vote fraud, if you accuse Carter Mondale of masterminding vote fraud, then you reopen all the terrible wounds. So it's better to capitulate. It's better to go gracefully into the night and not fight to vote for it, even though it could have been done. And it was some of this stuff was actually proven in court by people who were concerned about the integrity of the election. But since Ford was not fighting, there was nothing that could be done. So this is then what happened. Of course, Ford is smart enough to realize that if Happy Rockefeller is telling Betty this is Nelson, and therefore this is the banking community that has more Lynette Squeaky Fromms and more Sarah Jane Moores in the background, so he better do it. And that's how we get the disastrous Carter administration. I hasten to point out, I think Carter in the last couple of years, especially in the last 6 months or so, has done many, many good and useful things. But we have to hold on also to the fact that the Carter presidency was a disaster and that he was pre-programmed with these people like Volcker and Brzezinski and the Trilateral Commission expressing, you know, a new wave of policy coming out of the banking community. So that's the end of the Ford presidency.
I'm speaking with author and historian Webster Tarpley. Today's show, The Ford Presidency. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, there's one last thing that I think is worth discussing, and this would be the co-presidency. That is the flurry of interest in the summer of 1980 that Gerald Ford might now run for vice president as the number two man on a ticket led by Ronald Reagan, right? Ford had been sparring with Reagan, right? Ford is obviously a liberal financier Republican. Reagan is somebody who is slightly different in his cultural background, really not important, but, you know, they're fighting also about careers, right? The personal rivalry, ambition, and all the rest of it. By the time we get to 1980, we have a situation where the establishment, the bankers, are willing to accept Reagan as president, but they want a financier agent as vice president, and that's going to be George H.W. Bush, Bush the Elder, father of the current tenant of the White House. The problem now is that Reagan hates Bush. Reagan is deeply convinced that Bush is not qualified to be president, that he's mentally unstable, immature, politically stupid, and so forth. How did he get this? Right? Because Reagan, of course, is not an eagle. Reagan is somebody also of limited mental equipment in the same way that Ford has been. The scene, however, is that Reagan sees it all acted out in front of him. In New Hampshire, you can look at my book again, George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, the Campaign 1980 chapter. We're talking now about the Nashua Telegraph debate of February 1980. Now, people may remember this. This is the one where the moderator says, "Turn off Governor Reagan's microphone." And Reagan says, "I'm paying for this microphone, Mr. Green." Right? People remember these exchanges. The basis of this was somehow Bush the Elder was trying to position himself as the main alternative to Ronald Reagan, who was the leading candidate. There were other Republicans in the field, but by inveigling and by, you know, various kinds of intrigue, Bush the Elder was able to get a debate set up, sponsored by this local newspaper, the Nashua, New Hampshire Telegraph, where it would be Bush the Elder against Ronald Reagan and everybody else excluded. At the night that this debate is going to take place, however, the other candidates appear, the other candidates being U.S. Senator Robert Dole, who had run for vice president, Congressman John Anderson, Congressman Phil Crane, a conservative worthy from Illinois, Howard Baker, Senator Howard Baker, right, who had been an important Republican senator, right, back in Watergate. So they say, look, it's unfair to have a debate with only two. All of us should participate. At that point, Ronald Reagan, with his sunny, avuncular disposition, says, sure, let them all speak. And this is what the crowd wants. They say, get chairs for all these fine Republicans and let's have a real good Republican debate. George Bush is up on the stage and he says, no, 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 never, never, never. It's my debate, you know, it's my party and I'll exclude whoever I want. So and this goes on, right? And this is one of the reasons that Bush loses the primaries, because he basically has a little Lord Fauntleroy fit in front of the cameras and in front of this public. And through this, Reagan says, my God, this person, he doesn't have the elementary political gifts. any smart Paul would say, sure, you know, I have to bow to the inevitable and make my image, you know, intact as much as I can. But not Bush the Elder, right? He has this hyperthyroid storm moment in this debate. So Reagan is convinced that he doesn't want Bush. So here's what they do. An intrigue is mounted. Gerry Ford is the bait. Henry Kissinger is brought in as a negotiator. And through various means, they plant the idea in Reagan's head that Gerald R. Ford might well be willing to come on the ticket as the vice presidential candidate. But, of course, he's got, you know, conditions, right? He wants to get certain things for himself. He wants to control foreign policy. He wants to have Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State again. He wants to have Alan Greenspan as Secretary of the Treasury, you know, bringing on this whole crew of discredited invisible government characters from his own administration. Basically wants to pack the Reagan administration, which is a different sociological group, with these same, you know, liberal New York banking types. So Reagan is drawn into this negotiation. Now, essentially, the whole thing was never in good faith. It was never serious. But what it was to play on the fact that Reagan is dumb, and then keep going with these back and forth. Kissinger is shuttling back and forth, his greatest shuttle diplomacy. They bring new conditions to Reagan. They take Reagan's responses back to Ford, back to Reagan, back to Ford. And all of a sudden, it's the night at the convention where Reagan has got to name a vice presidential candidate. And at this point, Ford drops out. He says, well, I don't think we'll be able to do this. I guess I better take myself out of contention. At this point, Reagan has about 2 or 3 hours left, and he's got to name a vice president. It's time. And if he doesn't do it, he looks like a fool, right? He looks like somebody who can't face, you know, the first big choice of running for president. Who's the vice president? So at that point, he picks up the phone and he calls Bush. He says, George, would you like to come on the ticket? I'd be honored, Governor, and that's it. But he does it holding his nose, and he does it with a real revulsion against Bush, because he's convinced that Bush is not qualified to be president. Now, the proof of all this also, it's in my book, George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography. As Ford is leaving the Republican convention, he's asked by a journalist who meets him at the airport, hey, President Ford, hey, Gerry, what did you think of the convention? And Ford says, I'm very happy with the convention. I came here with one main thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to make sure that George Bush was the vice presidential candidate. I succeeded. It's Bush for vice president, and that's going to be wonderful. This, of course, was not what the delegates wanted. If you've ever heard the moment when Reagan, breaking with tradition, goes to the convention and says, I'm not going to nominate Ford, I'm going to nominate Bush. There's a boo and a groan at the name of Bush, because Bush, of course, is a financier, liberal Republican that these right-wing characters and the, you know, the dominant people in the Republican Party by then don't want. So that is essentially the story with Ford.
Now, Webster, you have spoken about powerful forces that want to weaken the presidency, and that had a lot to do with Nixon being Watergated. But do you think it would be more correct to say that they wanted a weakened president as the individual rather than a weakened office of the presidency?
Well, I think you can find, if you compare it, say, to the some of these things get into comparisons that are complex, but if you look at Andrew Johnson's impeachment but then non-conviction, you would have to say that the presidents coming after Johnson, people like Grant and Arthur and people like this, represent it's a very weak phase of the presidency. In other words, an attempted impeachment tends to set up a presidency which is permanently weakened. And I would say the same thing concerning Clinton, that the Clinton impeachment certainly weakened Clinton. It made it possible, for example, for Al Gore to begin the bombing of Serbia in the spring of 1999, really without much reference to Clinton. It was really a decision by an oligarchy, right? That is to say, by the so-called Principals Committee. You can read about this in my book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA. When it came to bombing Serbia, Clinton was very ambivalent. Gore wanted it. This was the British geopolitical line, was let's bomb Serbia. But the group that put it through was not just Gore. It was Madeleine Albright. It was Secretary of Defense William Cohen, General Hugh Shelton, Richard Clark, the darling of the 9/11 Commission, and a few others. But there was essentially this thing called the Principles Committee that took power. So for the 1999-2000, power in the United States was not in the hands of Clinton. He had mortgaged his presidency very much to allow this to happen, to stay in office, and was essentially the Principles Committee that ran the country. And I would say even today, the presidency is permanently weakened. Look at Bush. This is not a strong president. For example, if the oil cartel decides that gasoline is going to cost $3.50 a gallon, they can do it because they're more powerful than the United States with a weak president like Bush. Again, as I try to write in my Bush bio, the model of a Bush presidency is a weak, passive executive who has no program except to take power and give jobs and money to cronies. A weak, passive president who sits in the Oval Office and waits for his handlers to come and tell him what it is that he must do. And you see that, for example, in Bush on the day of 9/11. He has no idea what to do. He has no idea of decisive executive action, even in the terms that he might have understood it in the school there in Florida. He just sits there, right, as people have pointed out. He doesn't respond in any way. He's catatonic. He's frozen. Obviously, there's much more going on behind it. But just in terms of what a president might have done, he doesn't do it. So I would say the goal is, again, to weaken the presidency as an institution by showing that presidents can be destroyed. The presidents can't fight back. In other words, if the New York banking community and the Boston Globe and the Washington Post and the New York Times decide that somebody is going to be destroyed, well, they're destroyed. And the CIA and the FBI and Henry Kissinger will pile on. Kissinger, of course, being a creature of Rockefeller, made great by Nelson Rockefeller in the 1950s, but then Kissinger also branching out to loyalties to people like Lord Cromer in London, or the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, extremely important in Kissinger's career. The idea that it's an oligarchy. In other words, the goal of the oligarchy is always to maintain oligarchy and to prevent anybody from actually exercising the constitutional powers of the presidency, because these would tend to negate the power of oligarchy. Again, look at Roosevelt, or even look at Kennedy. At a certain point, Roger Blau of United States Steel and a group of financiers and people running these corporations decide that they're going to raise the price of steel and they're going to renege on a deal they'd made with Kennedy. And Kennedy is able simply to mobilize the power of the federal government to crush Roger Blau, to make him back down. And this is one of the reasons that Kennedy has to be liquidated.
So, Webster, would you then say that the oligarchy wants a weak government generally, all three branches is weak, because Congress is weak as well?
Yes, I think that's essentially it. In other words, the demagogy that you can associate with Milton Friedman, let's say. Here's another departed person, but we've got to point out the monstrous evil of Milton Friedman. His demagogy is that big government per se is bad. Well, this is simply ridiculous. The question is, big government for whom? You've got to have a strong state. I would say you've got to have a state, a government, which is strong enough to defeat the likes of ExxonMobil and Halliburton and J.P. Morgan Chase. It's got to be a government that's capable of fighting back against these tremendous monopolies, oligopolies, cartels that are the essence of economic globalization. And if you have a weak government, you simply cannot, you can't do these things. And of course, the Congress has also been, beaten over the head. 9/11 is really the key to all of this in our own time. It's essentially that there's a network inside the institutions of the United States. Again, I call it the invisible government. In this case, we're talking about the action arm of the invisible government. We're talking about, in the 1963 case with Kennedy, it's the CIA Operations Directorate and its allies. Now, a lot of that has been privatized, so you're talking essentially about a rogue network that exists inside the Department of Defense, the CIA, the Special Forces Command, the National Security Council, NSA, DIA, the Treasury, you name it. It's all through there. But it's also got a large privatized component in the private military firms, the various defense contractors. A lot of this privatization was done under Reagan's Executive Order 12333 in the early 1980s. The Cold War CIA was essentially privatized into front companies, even more than it had been. So this group decides that they're going to change the foreign policy of the United States. They're going to attempt to reorganize the world around the war on terror by staging 9/11. Using their patsies, their Al-Qaeda, Atta, bin Laden, the rest of these people as boogeymen, running the stuff through military drills of the Pentagon and these private military firms, and then bringing about this stuff. And at that point, the Congress has basically ceased to exist. But it's also the presidency. Bush is president today because he eagerly rushed to capitulate to this unconstitutional coup d'etat that was 9/11. In other words, he's there as the spokesman for the coup group. He's not president of the United States in any meaningful sense. He's simply the person who was allowed to stay on. Right? He was an expendable puppet on 9/11. He knew it, and he did everything he could to show that he was going to go along with what was happening. In the same way that Gerald Ford could see that there was a coup d'etat against Nixon and decided to become part of it and to become a beneficiary of it.
Webster Tarpley, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure always, and Happy New Year. Happy 2007. I think it'll be a year of convulsions and cataclysms, but I hope it's a happy one anyway.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with author and historian Webster Tarpley. Today's show, The Ford Presidency. Webster Tarpley is an author, historian, investigative journalist, and lecturer. In 1992, he co-authored George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, which still stands as the only comprehensive and critical account of the former president and his family network. Posted for free on the internet since October 1996 at www.tarpley.net, this study has become an underground classic. Tarpley is also author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, Surviving the Cataclysm, A Study of the World Financial Crisis, and Against Oligarchy, a collection of essays and speeches from the years 1970 to 1996. His books are available at Amazon.com. Webster Tarpley's program, World Crisis Radio, can be heard every Saturday on the internet at www.rbnlive.com. That's RBNLIVE.com. Visit his website at www.tarpley.net. Email him at tarpley@tarpley.net. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yarrow Mako. To leave comments or order copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear from the late stand-up comedian and satirist Bill Hicks, who died young 20 years ago. A sharp critic with much talent, and he was funny too. I hope you'll stay tuned. Satirist and stand-up comedian Bill Hicks died 20 years ago, February 26, 1994. He died of cancer of the pancreas at age 32. He had and has many fans and admirers, but he is not as widely known as, for instance, George Carlin. At his death, Hicks was younger and rougher and less skilled than Carlin. But he was very promising and maturing quickly. Both Hicks and Carlin were radical critics of America, as a satirist must be. Carlin's radical view grew gradually over several decades. Bill Hicks's radical view emerged early, but alas, he died young. Let's start with some overtly political sketches. These are from the early 1990s. Here's a piece on America's brief so-called Gulf War, now called Gulf War I. If war is the right term for this 1991 American slaughter of Iraqis. And here the phrase, President George Bush, refers to George Bush I, George Herbert Walker Bush. During this war, American jingoism and false patriotism were flooding the streets, not to mention the airwaves. Like Carlin, Bill Hicks wasn't having any of it. Here he is, explaining the Gulf War to Canadians.
So I'm from the States, as you can tell by my complete lack of sophistication, but that's okay. And during the, we had this big war thing happen. I don't know if you caught any of that, but it was a very stressful time for me, the war. I'll tell you why. I was in the unenviable position of being for the war, but against the troops. And not the most popular stance I've ever taken on an issue, I must say. I don't choose wisely always, and yet I'm committed. So, first of all, this needs to be said. There never was a war. How can you say that, Bill? Well, a war is when two armies are fighting. So you see, right there, I think we can all agree it wasn't exactly a war. And Bush, President Bush, a complete surprise, he turned into a demon man. When he was first president, they called him the wimp president. I mean, this was the cover of Newsweek. Wimp president. Apparently, this stuck in this guy's craw. Guy turned into a demon man. We surrender. Not good enough. We run away. Too little, too late. We're having way too much fun. Those guys were in hog heaven out there. You understand, man? They had a big weapons catalog opened up. What's G12 do, Tommy? Well, it says here it destroys everything but the fillings in their teeth. Helps us pay for the war effort. Well, pull that one up. Pull up G12, please. Cool. What's G13 do? Weapons for all occasions. And everyone got excited about the technology, and I guess it was pretty incredible watching a missile fly down an air vent. Pretty unbelievable. But couldn't we feasibly use that same technology to shoot food at hungry people? You know what I mean? Fly over Ethiopia. There's a guy that needs a banana. The stealth banana. Smart fruit. And I watched the Iraqian technology. Man, I've never felt so good about myself. What was the technology they were buying? Where do they, are those available still now? Or where do they, could get harder off the streets of New York right now, man. Don't you think one of the key prerequisites of a weapon system is, I don't know, the ability to aim the thing? Is that, I don't know a lot about the military, and yet I feel that would be key. What was the Scud? It was like launching a station wagon at people, man. Some Buick flying through the air, some Iraqi driving. Allah! Watch out, here come one of them Buick Scuds. Watch out, up in the ocean. Those things are so hard to steer. Bloop, bloop, bloop. Another Buick Scud. I guess the most amazing thing about the war, obviously the disparity in the casualties. Iraq, 150,000 casualties. USA, 79. Let's go through those numbers again. They're a little baffling at first glance. Iraq, 150,000. USA, 79. Does that mean if we had sent over 80 guys, we still would have won that thing, or what? Just one guy in a ticker tape parade. I did it, hey! Peel said, Bill, Iraq had the fourth largest army in the world. Yeah, well, maybe, but you know what? After the first three largest armies, there's a real big drop-off, okay? The Hare Krishnas are the fifth largest army in the world. And they've already got our airports. So, who is the greater threat? People that bugged me in the States, people said, hey, war made us feel better about ourselves.
Really?
Who are these people with such low self-esteem? They need a war to feel better about themselves. I saw them on the news waving their flags. Could I recommend, instead of a war to feel better about yourself, perhaps sit-ups? Maybe a fruit cup? 6 to 8 glasses of water a day? I'm not telling you how to live. I'm just recommending perhaps a better way to feel better about yourself. And we can avoid a conflagration. Merely a suggestion.
One more quick political sketch by Bill Hicks. Here he is, expressing a view you will never find in the establishment news media, the view that the President of the United States is but the servant of the country's really powerful people. I came to this opinion too, but not before I had reached late middle age. Bill Hicks had caught on to the scam by the time he was 30.
I have this feeling, man, because you know there's a handful of people actually run everything. That's true. It's provable. I'm not a conspiracy nut. It's provable. Handful, very small elite run and own these corporations, which include the mainstream media. I have this feeling who's ever elected president, like Clinton was, no matter what the promises you promise on the campaign trail, blah, 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 when you win, you go into this smoky room with the 12 industrialists, capitalists, scum who got you in there, and you're in this smoky room and this little screen comes down, and a big guy in a cigar, roll the film. And it's a shot of a Kennedy assassination from an angle you've never seen before. That looks suspiciously off the grassy knoll. And then the film, the screen goes up, and the lights come up, and they go to the new president. Any questions? Just what my agenda is. First we bomb Baghdad. You got it.
Bill Hicks was born in Georgia, and he spent his earliest years in the South. At age 7, his family moved to Houston, Texas, and stayed. A few weeks ago, his fellow Houstonian, Scooter, put together a nice Hicks collection, suitably censored for radio broadcast, as my own selections have been. Scooter does a weekly radio show on KPFT called The Inner Side, and he is generous about sharing his stuff. And I'll play some of it now. Here we'll hear Bill Hicks's reflections on the brain-dead life in the South, and then on the movement to allow gays into the military. That was a big crusade back then. And then he considers the hypocrisy of the still ongoing war on drugs. Here's Bill Hicks.
You got to bear with me. I'm very tired of traveling and very tired of doing comedy and very tired of staring out at your vacant faces looking back at me, wanting me to fill your empty lives with humor you couldn't possibly think of yourselves. Good evening. It's been a while since I've been here. It's great to be back wherever I am. I always love it when I'm here. Lots happened, I guess. Been on what I call my flying saucer tour, which means, like flying saucers, I too have been appearing in small southern towns in front of handfuls of hillbillies lately, and been doubting my own existence. I've noticed a certain anti-intellectualism in this country. Have you noticed that? Ever since around 1980, coincidentally enough. Last week I was in Nashville, Tennessee. After the show, I went to a Waffle House. I'm not proud of it, but I was hungry. And I'm sitting there and I'm eating and I'm reading a book, right? I'm alone. I don't know anybody. I'm eating and I'm reading a book. Fine, right? Waitress comes over to me. What's he reading for? I said, wow, I've never been asked that. God dang it, you stumped me. Not what am I reading, but what am I reading for? I guess I read for a lot of reasons, but one of the main ones is so I don't end up being a waffle waitress. Then this trucker in the next booth gets up, stands over me and goes, well, looks like we got ourselves a reader. What's going on here? It's like I walked into a Klan rally in a Boy George costume or something, you know? This is a book I read. Am I stepping out of some intellectual closet here? There, I said it. I feel better. I'm telling you, man, there's some serious pockets of humanity out there. Go to some of these truck stops in the middle of nowhere, order coffee. Guy behind the counter goes, you want the 32 ounce or the large? Oh, boy, that sounds like a lot of coffee, man. I don't know if I want to be awake that long in Tennessee, you know? They're nice people. They are. What would you describe them as? Rural? Backwoods? Hicks? After the show, one of them came up to me real excited. Man, you're great. You're cracking me up. I was about to spit. Sorry. Said, no, I loved it. I'd like you to meet my wife and sister. And there was one girl standing there.
See my attitude in the press. That's what bugs me. You never see my point of view. For instance, gays in the military. Now, I don't know how y'all feel about it. Gays want to be in the military. Here's how I feel about it. All right? Anyone dumb enough to want to be in the military should be allowed in. End of story. That should be the only requirement
I don't care how many push-ups you can do. Put on a helmet. Go wait in that foxhole. We'll tell you when we need you to kill somebody. You know what I mean? I'm so sick. I've watched these congressional hearings and all these military guys and all the pundits seriously. Oh, the esprit de corps will be affected, and we are such a moral... Excuse me, aren't you hired killers? Shut up! Where did the military get all these moral... We are the military. Is that a village of children and kids? Where's the napalm? I don't want any gay people hanging around me while I'm killing kids. I just don't want to see it. I don't know what my attitude is. I'm trying to work on it all the time, you know. I'm drinking water tonight. That's pretty amazing. Water. It's really weird how your life changes. You know what I mean? Water. 4 years ago, opium. Isn't that weird? I mean, really. It's night and day. Some of y'all may remember me as a drinker. I was a weekend drinker. You know, I'd start on Saturday, end on Friday, and thought I was controlling it there. But I don't drink anymore. I don't do drugs anymore either than, I'd say, the average touring funk band. If I had to add it up. But I'll tell you something about drugs. I used to do drugs, but I'll tell you something honestly about drugs, honestly, and I know it's not a very popular idea. You don't hear it very often anymore. It is the truth. I had a great time doing drugs. Sorry. Never murdered anyone, never robbed anyone, never raped anyone, never beat anyone, never lost a job, a car, a house, a wife, or kids, laughed my ass off, and went about my day. Sorry. Now, where's my commercial? Why don't I get a commercial? Why is it always that other guy that gets the commercial? I lost my job, then my house, then my wife, then my car, then my kids. Don't do drugs. Well, I'm definitely not doing them with you. Man, you're bumming me out. Get him out of here. Who invited Mr. Doom over? Get that guy out of here. He hadn't stopped talking. I wish he'd lose his voice. I mean, I've lost my car before. Okay. Found it the next day. You know, no biggie. I don't think that warranted a commercial. I lost my car, and, there it is by that dumpster. Forget it. See you tomorrow. I knew we were in trouble in that damn egg commercial, that guy. I knew that was the government's take on drugs. You know where to believe me. Here's your brain. I've seen a lot of weird drugs. I've never, ever, 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 ever looked at an egg and thought it was a brain. Not once, all right? I have seen UFOs split the sky like a sheet, but I have never, ever, ever looked at an egg and thought it was a brain. Not once. I have had 7 balls of light come off of a UFO, lead me onto their ship, explain to me telepathically that we are all one and there is no such thing as death, but I have never, ever, ever, ever looked at an egg and thought it was a brain. Now, maybe I wasn't getting good. I admit it, I see that commercial, I feel cheated. Hey, where's the stuff that makes eggs look like brains? That sounds neat. Did I quit too soon? What is that, CIA stash? See the guy in that commercial? Guy's got a beer gut. All right, this is it. Look at it, man. This is your brain. I ain't doing this again. That's your brain. The guy's drunk doing the commercial, man. Here's your brain. That's an egg. That's a frying pan. That's a stove. You're an alcoholic. Dude, I'm tripping right now. And I still see that as an egg, all right? I see the UFOs around it, but that is a damn egg in the middle. There's a hobbit eating it, but damn it, that hobbit is eating an egg. He's on a unicorn, but that, no, that's an egg, yeah. How dare you have a wino tell me not to do drugs? Why did I quit? Because after you've been taken aboard a UFO, it's kind of hard to top that, all right? You know why? If I was going to have a drug be legal, it would not be alcohol. You know why? There's better drugs and better drugs for you.
That's a fact. So you can stop your internal dialogue. Well, wait a minute, Bill. Alcohol is an acceptable form of social interaction, which for thousands of years has been the norm under which human beings have congregated and formed social events, and they would congregate. Shut up. Your denial is beneath you, and thanks to the use of hallucinogenic drugs, I see through you. Pot is a better drug than alcohol. Fact, and I'll prove it to you. You're at a ball game, you're at a concert, someone's really violent, aggressive, and obnoxious. Are they drunk or are they smoking pot? The one and only correct answer. Tell them what they want, Johnny. I've never seen people on pot get in a fight because it is impossible. Say you get in a car accident and you've been smoking pot. You're only going 4 miles an hour. We hit something. Forgot to open the garage door, man. Yeah. You gotta get the garage door open so Domino's knows we're home. But I'll tell you the truth. I have never heard one reason that rang true why marijuana is against the law. That rang true now. I'm not talking about the reasons the government tells us, because I hope you know this. I think you do. All governments are lying suckers. Yeah! I hope you know that. Good. All right. I mean, marijuana grows everywhere. It serves 1,000 different functions, all of them positive. To make marijuana against the law is like saying God made a mistake. You know what I mean? It's like God on the seventh day looked down at his creation and said, there it is, my creation, perfect and holy in all ways. Now I can rest. Oh, my me. I left pot everywhere. I should never have smoked that joint on the third day. If I leave pot everywhere, that's going to give people the impression they're supposed to use it. Now I have to create Republicans. So you see, it's a vicious cycle. And I'm not promoting the use of drugs, believe me. I'm not. I've had bad times on drugs, okay? I mean, look at this haircut.
Like many comedians, Bill Hicks spent some time criticizing TV programming, but he went a little farther than most. Here he is, imagining the night Jay Leno commits suicide on camera.
Kind of bummed because I'm missing right now, even as we speak, my favorite cultural train wreck, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Me and my friends have a little office pool wondering exactly which episode and which guest is going to be on the night Jay finally puts a 9mm in his mouth and blows his Dorito-shilling head off his body. I think it's going to be Joey Lawrence from the show Blossom. Other of my friends beg to differ and think Patrick Duffy a more likely culprit.
So, hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Tonight we have Joey Lawrence. Hi, Joey. How are you? It's good to see you again. Boy, it was always my comedic dream to be 44 years old and interviewing a little Tony Danza wannabe every 3 months. Boy, I'm fulfilled as a human spiritually. So anyway, Joey, you're 16 now? You're 16 years old?
Yeah.
That's great. You're 16. You got a license? You driving? You driving?
Yeah.
Okay, 16, got a license. You got a car? You got a car?
Yeah.
You got a girlfriend? You dating somebody? Anybody special?
Yeah, no. Well, she thinks so, I don't.
Good God, what have I done with my life?
His brain splew out, forming an NBC peacock on the wall behind him.
The next night, bam 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 bam. Ed,
enjoy your vacation?
You are correct, sir.
Doc, that's a really nice red coat. Is that the color of it, or is that Jay's brains?
It all started when he did the Doritos commercial. Here's the deal, folks. You do a commercial, you're off the artistic roll call forever. Everything you say is suspect, and every word that comes out of your mouth is now like a turd falling into my drink. You do a commercial, you're off the artistic roll call forever. And that goes for everyone except Willie Nelson. 24 million dollar tax bill. Willie was a little looser than the rest of us. I just avert my eyes when he sings about tacos. You know what I mean? It's so.
I'm sitting here selling tacos, oh, waiting for the woman in the rose tattoo. My butt is so loose.
Oh, this is so sad. Is he done yet? Nope.
I love nachos with chips and dip and love the things that I can get. And oh, my butt is hurting me.
Oh, God, let's pass the hat. Get him off the Taco Bell commercial. We gotta save Willie.
In a minute, we'll let Bill Hicks have the last word. So I'm going to say goodbye now. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Thanks to Scooter for some of the recordings we played. You'll find more stuff of his at his website, accessofevil.org. That's spelled A-K-S-I-S, accessofevil.org. And you'll find more stuff by us at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum, and, as Bill Hicks will explain, American culture is an amusement park ride from hell, but we can still climb off. Ciao.
Is there a point to all this? Let's find a point. Is there a point to my act? I would say there is. I have to. The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud. And it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people. Shut him up. We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real. It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok. But it doesn't matter, because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace. Thank you very much. You've been great. I hope you enjoyed it. London, you're fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 4th, 1968, was the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. According to the outcome of the 1999 trial brought by the King family, Martin Luther King's assassination was a state crime against democracy, or a SCAD. Here's what Professors Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff of Project Censored had to say in a March 2010 article posted on globalresearch.ca called State Crime Against Democracy. New research in the journal American Behavioral Scientist, Sage Publications, February 2010, addresses the concept of state crimes against democracy, or SCAD. Professor Lance DeHaven-Smith from Florida State University writes that SCADs involve high-level government officials, often in combination with private interests, that engage in covert activities for political advantages and power. Proven SCADs since World War II include McCarthyism, Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, burglary of the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Florida's 2000 election, and fixed intelligence on WMDs to justify the Iraq War. Other suspected SCADs include the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, the shooting of George Wallace, the October surprise near the end of the Carter presidency, military-grade anthrax mailed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, Martin Luther King's assassination, and the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 on September 11, 2001. The proven SCADs have a long trail of congressional hearings, public records, and academic research establishing the truth of the activities. The suspected SCADs listed above have substantial evidence of covert actions with countervailing deniability that tend to leave the facts in dispute. The term conspiracy theory is often used to denigrate and discredit inquiry into the veracity of suspected SCADs. Labeling SCAD research as conspiracy theory is an effective method of preventing ongoing investigation from being reported in the corporate media and keep them outside of broader public scrutiny. Psychologist Laurie Manuel, University of Guelph, addresses the psychological advantage that SCAD actors hold in the public sphere. Manuel, writing in American Behavioral Science, states, "Research shows that people are far less willing to examine information that disputes rather than confirms their beliefs. Pre-existing beliefs can interfere with SCAD's inquiry, especially in regards to September 11, 2001. Since this month marks the 44th anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, I'm going to replay part of a show that aired in early 2009 about that trial and other SCADs. So here's part of that earlier show. Since we just celebrated Martin Luther King Day in many communities around Connecticut, I thought I would share with you something that's not widely known, something that I've never read in a corporate newspaper and I've never seen on corporate television news either. A civil trial was held in November of 1999 that found that James Earl Ray actually didn't kill Martin Luther King, and the trial uncovered who actually did. And it turns out it was a conspiracy. Attorney William Pepper represented the King family in the trial and then wrote a book about the trial, including all of the evidence, called An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. Here's what it says on the inside jacket of the book. On the evening of April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King was in Memphis supporting a workers' strike, By the end of the day, top-level Army snipers were in position to knock him out if ordered. Two military officers were in place on the roof of a fire station near the Lorraine Motel to photograph the events. Two black firemen had been ordered not to report to duty that day, and a black Memphis Police Department detective on surveillance duty in the fire station was physically removed from his post and taken home. Dr. King's room at the motel was changed from a secluded ground floor room to number 306 on the balcony. Boyd Jowers, owner of Jim's Grill, which backed onto the motel from the other side of the street, had already received $100,000 in cash for his agreement to participate in the assassination. He was to go out into the brush area behind the grill with the shooter and take possession of the gun immediately after the fatal shot was fired. When the dust settled, King had been hit, and a cleanup procedure was immediately set in motion. James Earl Ray was effectively framed, the snipers dispersed, any witnesses who could not be controlled were killed, and the crime scene was destroyed. William Pepper, attorney and friend of Dr. King and the King family, became convinced after years of investigation that not only was Ray not the shooter, but that King had been targeted as part of a larger conspiracy to stop the anti-war movement and to prevent King from gaining momentum in his promising Poor People's Campaign. 10 years into the investigation, in 1988, Pepper agreed to represent Ray. While he was never able to successfully appeal the sentence before Ray's death, he was able to build an airtight case against the real perpetrators. In 1999, Lloyd Jowers and co-conspirators were brought to trial in a wrongful death civil action suit on behalf of the King family. 70 witnesses set out the details of a conspiracy in a plot to murder King that involved J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, the military, the local Memphis police, and organized crime figures from New Orleans and Memphis. The evidence was unimpeachable. The jury took an hour to find for the King family. But the silence following these shocking revelations was deafening. Like the pattern during all the investigations of the assassination throughout the years, no major media outlet would cover the story. It was effectively buried. Until now, the details, evidence, and personalities of all these nefarious characters have gone unreported. In an act of state, you finally have the truth before you, how the United States government effectively shut down one of the most galvanizing movements for social change by stopping its leader dead in his tracks. The book about this trial came out in 2003, and again the title is An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, by William Pepper. And now here's some background information about attorney William Pepper. Dr. William Pepper is a barrister in the United Kingdom and admitted to the bar in numerous jurisdictions in the United States of America. His primary work is international commercial law and practices international human rights law from London. Dr. Pepper convened a seminar on international human rights at Oxford University. He has represented governments in the Middle East, Africa, South America, and Asia. Dr. Pepper has lectured at many universities and has been interviewed on many major news programs. Dr. Pepper was a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King in the last year of his life. He is the author of 4 books, including An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, Jr. Today you're going to hear part of a speech that Dr. Pepper gave at the symposium in November of 2007, called 9/11 Family Members, First Responders, and Experts Speak Out. That was held in West Hartford. And so here he is, Dr. William Pepper, discussing Martin Luther King, 9/11, and many other issues. He's talking about the COINTELPRO infiltrating peace groups and other organizations.
To become a part of your movement, and sometimes they will have very radical and very crazy ideas to put forward to the group. They're provocateurs. And for people who have not been politically active over the years, who've seen this phenomenon, that all governments do it, it becomes a bit of a shock when the light dawns. So it's very important to be wary of that and to be cautious. That doesn't mean you're being suspicious of your neighbor. It means that you think for yourselves about what you believe in, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. The most extreme example of provocateurs and provocation that I've experienced was in Chicago, Labor Day in Chicago in 1967, where we held the National Conference for New Politics, and I was executive director of that at Martin King's request. I had been a journalist in Vietnam, as some of you know, and had come back from Vietnam, having been shot down in a C-130 crash landing, and had to come back for some treatment. But they were happy to see me go because I was never at the 5 o'clock follies. I was always out in the shelters and orphanages and out in the country trying to see what was going on. So I took photographs that eventually appeared on utility poles all over the world, showing burned children and shrapnelized pregnant women and things of that sort that Americans, of course, had never seen before. And Martin King subscribed to a magazine called Ramparts. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Ramparts. But Ramparts ran an article that I wrote in January issue of 1968. Martin read it. 67, and Martin read it and asked me then to work with him, open all the files I had, which I did, and he wept when he saw some, literally wept when he saw some of the devastation. And then for that last year of his life, only the last year, but for that last year of his life, we worked on, there were two projects, and one primarily was a ticket, a third-party King Spock ticket, and the National Conference for New Politics brought 5,000 delegates from all over the country. Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party people were there, the SANE Nuclear Society, from the center-left all the way to the radical SDS groups, Hayden and those folks were there. And it was a threat to the Johnson administration, without any question, because Dr. King was who he was, and Dr. Spock, of course, was very popular with whole other segments of the community. And so here we're having this opening night in this convention. Dr. King is to keynote it. And I introduce him and then sit down, and he's into his speech, and someone passes a note over my shoulder to me. And I looked at this note, and it said, "Get him out of here as soon as he finishes speaking, or we will take him hostage and embarrass him before the world." Now, that note was given to me by one of the members of a group called the Black Caucus. The Black Caucus had been formed, and they were organizing every black delegate to the convention to go into a special caucus, which in terms of its purposes and stated goals was fine. But what we were to learn years later was that Black Caucus was, in fact, being honchoed by Blackstone Rangers and gangs and gang leaders and people who were on Daley's poverty payroll for the precise purpose of breaking up the convention and splitting it. So we had no idea about this. So Dr. King finished his speech, and we had to get him out of there. The risk was too great with these people. The rest of the convention was wrecked because one resolution after another was introduced with the precise purpose of dividing one organization against another and splitting apart that movement. And Dr. King was a unifier, and he had to be removed so that division could take place. So that kind of activity goes on. It goes on today, and I just ask you to please to be aware of it and look out for it in terms of your own work. Now, I guess one of the tasks that I undertake in these kinds of sessions is to bring 9/11 into a much broader context, because it could be very easy for people who are for the first time becoming politically active and who are outraged about the atrocity of 9/11 and government malfeasance and cover-up and all the rest of that to see 9/11 as standing alone. Well, it is a seminal issue. In our lifetime, maybe the most important seminal issue, no question about it. But you have to see it in a total context of governmental operations. Understand, this is not the first time that government or governments try to put people under stress and anxiety and justify oppression where they deprive liberty and deny a constitutional, even its very existence in some instances. This is not the first time that's happened. And it's not the first time that it's been attempted to be happened. Cynthia mentioned Northwoods. Many of you may know what Northwoods is. Some of you may not know what Northwoods is. Northwoods, of course, was Admiral Lemnitzer's grand plan to have United States Special Forces operatives dressed as and impersonating Cubans in a variety of city streets and selectively killing Americans to justify the invasion of Cuba. That was in 1959. Lemnitzer worked that plan up under John Foster Dulles. Well, of course, It was put on Kennedy's desk, and when he was elected, and he said, what are these guys, nuts? Are they crazy? What's going on with these idiots? And, of course, Kennedy threw that plan into the waste paper basket. Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City is another example, I think, of a situation where there was $3 billion locked in counterterrorism legislation, had been locked there for a period of time, had been blocked, had not been allocated. Oklahoma City bombing takes place. The building comes down. All that money gets released, and there are jobs for the boys and money for the well-connected and the cronies as a result of that. You know, McVeigh blew the front off that building with his fertilizer, and he thought he did it. He thought that he actually did it. When I was in London, somebody sent me these rolled-up sheets of paper, and I assumed, when I looked at it, that it was being sent to me by a member of the Corps of Engineers who had a conscience and who was concerned, and who had participated in the wiring. When I went through it, it was the wiring plans for that building. And even today, as time lapses, people will come forward and say, yes, you know, I remember engineers running in there to take out unexploded bombs. So that was another example. World Trade Center 93, I mean, the FBI organized that whole operation. That's not even denied now. And they even said to the to the guys they entrapped, don't worry, these are not real. These are not real bombs. So governments do these things, don't they? In Russia, I was in Moscow around the time that the apartment buildings, I don't know if you recall that, there were apartment buildings blown up. And the word immediately went out from the Kremlin that it were the Chechens. And that they used that as a means and as a rationale for invading Chechnya and doing what they have done to the Chechen people and to the what was once a formidable city, Grozny, just destroying it. And at that point in time, friends of mine there said very clearly, this is an intelligence operation, this is an inside job, and they're about this in order to get into Chechnya and to use it for that purpose. There is the Berlin Disco. I mean, the Berlin Disco was laid at Gaddafi's door, like many things are laid at Gaddafi's door. We change scapegoats, don't we, from decade to decade. And, of course, Gaddafi has been a major scapegoat. And so Berlin Disco was laid at his door. But the German authorities had no hard evidence at all that the Libyans were involved. And that was used as a reason for the shelling, the missile shelling of Gaddafi's home in Tripoli and the killing of his 4-year-old daughter. When I went to Libya with President Chavez, we went through that demolished residence of Gaddafi's, and he hadn't touched a slab of cement. He left it just exactly the way it was following the bombardment and the loss of his daughter. So we have those situations, and in an imperialist way, what do we need to look at? We stole half of Mexico, didn't we? Huh? Polk's found a reason to justify the invasion of Mexico, and voila, we have Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, good parts of Southern California, and the Mexicans lost half of their country. We did the same thing with rationalized the taking of Cuba, 1898, the ejection of the Spanish in the Spanish-American War, and then we were going to return it. We're going to leave. One petty dictator after another gets put in there and supported and sustained by us until, of course, Fidel comes down from the Sierra Maestra and changes that whole scenario. But how much later, 59 years later, almost 60 years later, did he do that? Well, we've done that. We've done that to the Hawaiians as well. You know, there is a serious problem historically in this country about the use of imperialism and the use of political assassinations, and the use of overthrows, one after another. That's all kept from you in school. It's kept from us in school. Did you go? I grew up never hearing about any of these things. I'm sure that most of you shared that experience. We have to somehow learn about it on our own eventually. So we have supported oppressive tyrants throughout this hemisphere, some of the worst in Central and South America. I mean, Argentina and Chile are particularly bad horror stories. But that's all pre-Chavez. Chavez is having an impact on that, on the culture of that continent now. Well, there's so much righteous indignation on the part of these, justifiably on the part of these people. I mean, we overthrow Mossadegh, who's a secular leader, elected leader in Iran. A marvelous guy, but a nationalist, and he wants the Iranian people to have the benefit of Iranian oil. So Anglo-American oil has got to leave. we overthrow Mossadegh. We get him out and we put the Shah in because now he'll make the proper deals in terms of the oil and energy interests. Then we go in the next year to Guatemala, had elected president, became Arbenz, and we do the same thing for Arbenz. We overthrow him. And Guatemala has been a nightmare, hasn't it? Ever since. To this day, it's a nightmare. Tomorrow, Molina may be elected president. He was trained at the School of the Americas. He's an American-trained fascist torturer and murderer who now may be elected president once again in Guatemala. So this horrific story goes on and on and on. We support in every way, subsidize in every way, transnational corporations, particularly the agro corporations, send them into the hemisphere, let them destroy the economy, agricultural economy of these people, literally destroy it so that the farmers and their children have to move into the cities and try to find fabricating or other kinds of jobs because they can't compete with American products that are being imported to places like Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. So we destroy their economies, and then when they try to come north to find jobs to feed their families, we have this outrage about these immigrants trying to come here illegally. That double standard is just incredible. It's incredible. So 9/11 relates to all of these things. 9/11 relates to the destruction of the working class in this country. It relates to internal economic problems that are rising faster than the masters here might want them to. And through radicalizing and making people aware of the 9/11 issue, I think it's maybe very well in line for that swath to be cut quite away. We've incarcerated how many? Over 2 million now, isn't that right? Large percentages, of course, are black and Hispanic. Overwhelming, what is it now, over 90%, I suppose, are on drug-related charges. Medical problems by the rest of the world, but criminalized in the United States. And yet the United States has been historically the largest drug-dealing, drug-trading operation on the planet, in the history of the planet. How little do we recall, remember MENA, Arkansas, and you remember, and Bill Clinton as governor of Arkansas welcoming George Bush's aide to make the deals with respect to the drugs that were smuggled illegally into MENA and then picked up by the Bloods and the Crips and the various gangs and taken to the streets of American cities and sold with 50% of the profit coming for agency covert operations and 50% remaining with the gangs. America's had an ongoing, large drug-dealing operation of this sort, and look what we do to the characters who get pushed into that business in the streets and then incarcerated. In the southern states, we have perpetuated slavery, or at least indentured service, haven't we? Because what happens down there when you get sent to prison, or even to the county jails? I've spent time visiting a number of county jails and prisons in the south, and they rent that labor out. And it goes out, as it always went out, to some of the plantations. They may be owned by corporations now rather than individuals, but they rent it out. It goes there. Those guys go out. They work every single day. They have no say about this. So if they're not slaves because they're not physically owned, they're at least indentured servants because they are, in fact, owned, and they have a servitude to the state, for on behalf of the state. So that's not talked about. Not only are these places hellholes, but even their labor is not talked about and how that produces the kind of income that it does. So I think 9/11 exists in that context. It exists in the context of the whole range of executive orders that this president has signed. What you're doing here tonight and what your brothers and sisters in California picketing against Chevron may be doing tomorrow or were doing last week could be called a felony. They could arbitrarily pick you up as they could pick up those people because there is a relationship, particularly in terms of the Chevron people, to the economic reconstruction of Iraq. And if you do anything that harms the economic reconstruction efforts of Iraq, like stopping Chevron, which is a major bidder for the privatization of Iraqi oil, if you try to stop that, you are interfering with the reconstruction of that country. That's a felony. They can pick you up. They will take your house. They will take your cars. They will take all of your assets. And goodness knows what they will then do to you. That's where we've come to in this country at this point. And it's very important to understand that, because it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. How is it going to get worse? Well, KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, were given a $385 million contract in February. And they were given a contract for what purpose? To build concentration camps in the United States. Now, there are an additional over 600 facilities that qualify presently for refurbishment for the same purpose. And the slight rationale is, well, if we get a huge influx of thousands and thousands of illegal immigrants, we got to have some place to put them. So we're going to build these camps in strategic areas of the country. Well, how many thousands of illegal immigrants are going to end up in Maine, are going to end up in Indiana, are going to end up in this state, Connecticut? Every state is targeted for these places. So that immediately begins to, even the most skeptical say, well, what's that all about? And if KBR has a $385 million contract as we sit here, you can bet the cost overruns on that will soon appear as they go on. Well, a lot of people will say, a lot of historians, I know some historians will say, but you know, we've been through this before. This is a swinging of the pendulum to the right, and it'll swing back as it always has before. And they point to the Palmer raids and the arrest of Eugene Debs, and he was sentenced to 10 years, and Palmer raids resulted in hundreds of arrests. And after World War I was over, then they were released. What they don't say about that, of course, was that the Bureau of Intelligence and military intelligence before that were gathering files on black people in particular across the country, and those files remained right straight on down to the present day, because they regarded black people as being the best target for Communist Party membership, and of course the Russian Revolution had taken place. But World War I is over, so they're released, so that's okay. World War II, we incarcerated 110,000 Japanese. We put them in camps. When World War II was over, then they were released. So people will point to these kinds of situations. We had the McCarthy hearings, and then the Senate turned on Joe McCarthy, and eventually he was discredited. And all of that's true. But there is a qualitative difference now. There is a substantial material difference now. This is a perpetual war. This is not a war that's going to end. This is a war that's going to exist continually. And if there are incidents here or abroad that they can use to heighten anxiety and justify more expenditures, of course they will use them. And if, as you move closer and closer to more explicit types of fascism, they will be justified on the basis of the fact that we are at war. This president continues to say, we are at war. And it is a war that's not going to end, says Rumsfeld. And it'll go on well beyond our lifetimes. They're sowing the seeds for keeping a nation in a militaristic frame of mind, militarizing the culture at every level. Anyone who sees what's going on the streets of urban America sees a qualitative change in the way the police are being trained to deal with problems in the streets. We are truly militarizing this society in an unprecedented fashion. And then we come to the next real war. Of course, you know that's Iran. Now there are people saying, no, there's no reason to invade. We really don't need to invade Iran. We can't handle it and all of that, and we shouldn't do it. Well, Nick Burns is Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East, that region. He had some quiet words with some colleagues of mine at Oxford. I convened a seminar on international human rights at Oxford University for 2 years before I took the time off to write a book on Hugo Chavez. And Burns was up there, and he spoke to some of my guys very candidly, and he said, I've been given until December 31st. And if I can't do what Chris Hill did with the North Koreans, get them totally to back down, he said, then it goes to Cheney's boys, and we will be at war. Now, the time frames always, there are variables, they always change, and maybe a little later than Burns was implying. If something is happening and El Baradei is jumping up and down saying, no, we need more discussions. But I think that war is probably inevitable.
And again, that was part of a speech given by Dr. William Pepper in West Hartford in November of 2007. To hear the complete speech, you can go to the website ct911truth.org. where you can also listen to the first 79 editions of 9/11 Wake Up Call. My more recent shows can be found at radioforall.net, and that's the number 4. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Kanesh.
Puerto Rico has a poverty rate approaching 50% and a public debt that amounts to over $20,000 per inhabitant, more than its median income of $19,000. While most of the attention in Puerto Rico's case focuses on technical issues relating to the solvency of municipal bonds and austerity measures, the history of U.S. policies have resulted in more than 3.5 million Puerto Ricans being treated as second-class citizens. With a poverty rate of more than 45%, more than double that of our poorest state, Mississippi, Puerto Rico has the serious long-term economic problem like its current massive public debt. And they have been historically papered over.
Meanwhile, the hedge fund vultures and Wall Street banks and lawyers charging over $1.4 billion in a seven-year period for charges like swap termination fees are circling Puerto Rico. They're sensing a physical death spiral they can feed off and care a little about the consequences for nearly 4 million residents as they manipulate a financial system largely devoid of any social conscience.
And indeed, while there has been a focus on the municipal bonds and austerity measures, really, the history of U.S. policies have resulted in more than 3.5 million Puerto Ricans being treated as second-class citizens. The bottom line is that Puerto Rico is the United States' largest colony that it decided to take by force 117 years ago and has since treated like a resented orphan. It has consistently undernourished politically and economically. Puerto Rico's current fiscal crisis is, in a sense, really a crisis of American colonial policies. And will the United States accept responsibility for the negative consequences of its imperialist past?
Professor Rafael Bernabe Refco, candidate for governor of Puerto Rico, talks with us about this and approaches for the island's recovery and more long-term solutions for Puerto Rico's fiscal problems.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, would you agree that the U.S. Congress's role really underlies this fiscal crisis, that it turned Puerto Rico into a bond haven with the triple tax exempt bonds? And if you continue to colonize a territory of 3.5 million U.S. citizens who fight your wars, pay into federal programs, and is underfunded by billions of dollars, demands a non-territorial status giving them sovereignty to control their economic and political destiny and are ignored, the territory will not have any option but to minimize the gaps in services by continuing to borrow. In short, isn't it primarily the island's territorial status and Congress's underfunding and unequal treatment of Puerto Rico that has really conspired to create the debt crisis that exists today?
Yes,
when people talk about the situation in Puerto Rico, they normally concentrate their attention on the debt issue. But behind the debt issue is the larger problem of the structure of Puerto Rico's economy. The Puerto Rican economy, ever since the early 1900s, since the establishment of U.S. rule in Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rican economy has been largely controlled by U.S. corporations. That was the case in the early 20th century when sugar was the main product, and it's still the situation today when certain industrial products are the main products of the island. But it is large U.S. corporations that control the Puerto Rican economy. One of the many consequences of that is that considerable profits are generated in Puerto Rico. You have sort of a paradox. You have a country which is highly indebted. It doesn't have any money for the government to function, but yet considerable profits are generated in Puerto Rico, and most of these profits are not reinvested in Puerto Rico. They leave the island every year. Economists calculate that U.S. corporations in Puerto Rico make about $35 billion in profits every year. That's about half of the total Puerto Rican debt in just one year. So you have an economy which doesn't work for the people who live in Puerto Rico, doesn't generate sufficient employment for the people in Puerto Rico, doesn't generate sufficient revenue for the government of Puerto Rico, but it does generate a considerable amount of profit for the U.S. corporations that operate in the island. So that helps you to partly explain why the government of Puerto Rico has borrowed an increasing amount of money in order to function. And as you mentioned, other policies established by Congress have stimulated that tendency. Bonds of the government of Puerto Rico are triply exempt. You don't have to pay municipal taxes, you don't have to pay state taxes, and you don't have to pay federal taxes on them. That makes them very attractive to investors. So it was relatively easy for a long period of time for the government of Puerto Rico to, instead of taxing corporations that operate in Puerto Rico, which is what it should have done, instead of taxing these profits that are generated in Puerto Rico and leave the island, to borrow more money. And needless to say, that has a limit, and the limit has been reached. So yes, there are many aspects of the way that Congress has organized or helped organize the Puerto Rican economy over the last century that lead to the present crisis. Right now, the most recent proposal that is being discussed in Congress, it's a proposal written by the Republican majority in Congress. It proposes to create an oversight board which would largely take over the government of Puerto Rico. It would decide what the budget of Puerto Rico is, what the main economic projects would be, and so on and so forth. So the present debt crisis is being used not to abolish or to diminish, but rather to assert colonial control over Puerto Rico in an even more direct way than it has been the case, you know, in the past few decades.
But even leaving aside that most odious part of the Republican proposal in Congress for this undemocratic, colonial-inspired oversight board, which would rob Puerto Ricans of any democratic control over their own economy, isn't this fixation on the debt itself something that takes our mind away from the real prize, which is how do we fix the economy of Puerto Rico?
Absolutely. There are two key issues here. One issue is a very immediate issue. It's the debt issue. The government of Puerto Rico right now is running out of money, literally speaking. Right now it has reached the point in which it either finances the services that the island needs or it pays the creditors. May 1, it has to pay about $400 million. And come July 1st, it has to pay $700 million. So that's $1.1 billion. And the government simply doesn't have the money. Or if it were to pay that, then it wouldn't have any money to function adequately. Unfortunately, the government of Puerto Rico should have understood this long ago and should have taken measures to prevent this situation from coming to this point. For example, last week, the government of Puerto Rico adopted a moratorium act which empowers the governor of Puerto Rico to suspend payments on the debt. We think that this should have been done much before. But as you say, we have to address this immediate debt question. But the deeper issue is the fact that the economy of Puerto Rico doesn't work. It hasn't grown. The economy of Puerto Rico has been in a situation of stagnation for the last 11 years. It hasn't grown in terms of income. It hasn't grown in terms of employment. It has lost, in fact, about a fifth of the jobs that existed in 2006 don't exist anymore. That's about 250,000 jobs that disappeared helps explain why many people are moving to the United States, because they just can't find jobs here in Puerto Rico. So you could even conceivably fix the debt issue, you know, in a short term. But if the economy of Puerto Rico doesn't start growing, then you're going to be back in a very critical situation very soon. What has to be looked into is changing, abandoning this notion that the development of Puerto Rico is going to keep depending exclusively on the attraction of U.S. corporations that would invest in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico has been trapped for many decades now in a vicious circle in which the island doesn't have capital to develop, so we attract U.S. corporations to come to Puerto Rico by offering to not charge them any taxes or very little taxes. They come to Puerto Rico, some of them do. They invest, they generate profits, but the profits are not reinvested in Puerto Rico. They leave the island. Therefore, the island doesn't have any capital. Therefore, it has to attract U.S. corporations and so on. It's a never-ending process of dependency on external investment, which not even in the best of cases was it able to generate sufficient employment for the island population. Right now, the unemployment rate in Puerto Rico is about 12%, the official unemployment rate. The labor participation rate is about 40%. In the United States, I think it's about 65 or something like that. That means that 60% of the people are working in working age are not even looking for a job. I mean, they have given up looking for a job because they know they won't find one. Out of those who are active in the labor force, 12% don't find a job. So when it comes down, you know, how you have 30% of the population actually able to find a job. It's an economic structure that doesn't function, even though it generates, as I said, considerable amount of profits for a small group of very large corporations, basically U.S. multinationals. So that whole economic structure has to be transformed. And unfortunately, we don't see in the initiatives that you see in Congress any significant moves towards in that direction in terms of questioning and enabling Puerto Rico to develop and to acquire an actually functioning economy, which is what it lacks at present.
Professor, the debt crisis is also a flesh and blood situation in Puerto Rico. You've spoken a little bit about this, but I was hoping you could flesh out further. What are the dilemmas now faced by the Puerto Rican people and the specific issues for the island's people, such as whether people in a village in Puerto Rico will even be able to get clean water?
The situation now is very critical. The government, up till now, even though the government proclaimed, admitted back in June of 2015 that the debt, as the governor said at that moment, is unpayable, it cannot be paid, he has continued paying it by and large. What that means is that it has been paid at the cost of increasing cuts in all sorts of government services, or not paying providers of different services. I'll give you a few examples. Last week, many school children were not able to go to school because the government had not paid and has not paid the people who operate the bus systems that take the children to school. So there are no buses for the children to go to school. In the same fashion, there are many students in Puerto Rico in the public school system which are what we call special education students, students that need particular teachers that deal with certain, you know, problems or situations that they have. These providers of special education have not been paid either. Many of them have been working without being paid for the longest time, and some of them have stopped working as a result of not being paid. They have trying to make a living in another fashion. So special education students are also suffering because of this situation. In the same fashion, there are unemployed people in Puerto Rico who receive a check, you know, support while they are unemployed from the government of Puerto Rico for a certain period of time. That has been, as you say, frozen at present. The payments that were due last week were not carried out because the government doesn't have any money to do it. In the case of the University of Puerto Rico, where I work, the budgetary assignations that the university receives every month in order to operate have also been cut or have not been paid at some point or another. So the budget of the university is also suffering as a result of this situation. The fact is that over the last 3 years, the government has, its priority has been to pay as much of the debt as possible at the expense of these and many other services that I have, as the ones that I have mentioned, which is, I think, the wrong priority. I think we think that 3 years ago, it was foreseeable that the government of Puerto Rico was going to reach a situation of not being able to pay the debt, And at that moment, 3 years ago, the government of Puerto Rico should have said this debt is unpayable, it's unsustainable, and we are going to suspend payment. And we demand of Congress that immediate action be taken in order to avoid a major crisis, which is what, you know, we are living now. This is what we should have tried to avoid, the critical situation. Now, the government, which up to now has done everything possible to pay the service of the debt, even that this government has been forced to admit that, no, we cannot keep paying. We have to stop payment. That's why they approved the moratorium law, which allows the governor to suspend payments if necessary, which is probably going to be the case very soon, unless Congress acts on this legislation that is now under consideration, in which case the whole framework of the situation in Puerto Rico may change from one day to the next. We will have to see what happens.
Professor Bernabe, one of the most virulent group of bondholders is the hedge funds and the vulture funds.
Yes.
Who hold anywhere from 30 to 40% of the debt, and they want their money now and couldn't give a damn whether people are starving in Puerto Rico. Why don't you talk about them and their policies are, who are they, and should they be recompensed for the entire face value of the debt in any case?
Yeah. This is one aspect of the Puerto Rican situation, which is still, some of it is still in the shadows. It's one of the reasons why we insist. One of the things the government has to organize, should have organized long ago, but must be organized now, is an audit of the debt. One of the things that such an audit of the debt would reveal is exactly who owns Puerto Rico's debt right now. Because, as you point out, over the last 2 years, as the fiscal situation in Puerto Rico worsened, many of the bondholders who had bought these bonds when they were issued at first have sold them in what they call the secondary market to other bondholders. Many of these bonds, we don't know exactly how many, have been acquired by so-called hedge funds or vulture funds, which operate in this fashion. That is, what they do is they buy bonds at a discount of countries or municipalities that are in financial trouble, and bondholders are happy or willing to or eager to sell these bonds, and they're willing to sell them at a lower price than they bought them. They sell them at a discount, and the hedge funds buy them at a discount, and then they will do everything possible to get paid 100% value on these bonds, and they will therefore have a tremendous profit. This is the way they operate. They take advantage of the weak. That's why they're called vulture funds. This is what they did in Argentina. This is what they have done in many places. And they have been operating, as you say, in Puerto Rico. And they have financed some studies which, you know, as you say, propose that Puerto Rico cut education services, cut health services, fire government employees, and so on and so forth. All sorts of cuts to be able to pay for this debt. It should be pointed out that to add a further loop to this situation is the fact that the government of Puerto Rico has approved over the last few years legislation that invites some of these large investors to come move to Puerto Rico. The way they do that is, again, to offer them tax exemption. They would have no taxes in Puerto Rico. So some of these hedge fund managers, such as John Paulson is the most notorious case, have moved to Puerto Rico. And they operate from here at least part of the year. And they have been acquiring major properties in Puerto Rico, major hotels and so on and so forth, resorts and so on. So you see a wave of takeovers by these funds of important economic activities in Puerto Rico. So, yes, this is part of the situation that we are confronting, the growing presence of these hedge funds and their very aggressive policies demanding payment on their investment and their unwillingness to consider the possibility of some sort of renegotiation of the debt.
I recently went to a lecture on the debt in Puerto Rico, and there are a number of legal scholars. One of them was Nelson Torres Rios, who is an attorney and professor at Hostos Community College. And one of the things that he pointed out, he cited to a Supreme Court case. And it said that a provision in a constitution that municipal corporations shall not become indebted in any manner nor for any purpose to an amount that exceeds its limit therein forbids implied as well as express indebtedness, and it is binding on a court of equity as well as on a court of law. In other words, the court is clearly saying that an ultra-virus transaction cannot be upheld by the court. So the conclusion there was, and actually something similar was used in Detroit by Judge Rose, that in fact Detroit's debt was obtained illegally as such, and that Detroit only had to pay a fraction of the debt as a result. I mean, there were also issues that were raised about international human rights principles that challenge the enforceability of odious debt. So I'm wondering if there is some consideration of these kinds of issues as a way of not paying back these debts, which there are those who would suggest are illegal to begin with.
Absolutely. This is one of the reasons why we insist on the need for an audit of the debt. Even before you renegotiate the debt, you should make sure that only debt which is legal should be paid. We should make sure that we are not renegotiating debt that should not be paid to begin with. And there are very good reasons to suspect that there are probably important portions of the debt of Puerto Rico which is illegal or inconstitutional. For example, as you mentioned, the Constitution forbids the Puerto Rican government the service of the debt of Puerto Rico to be higher than 15% of the revenue of the government of Puerto Rico. And over the years, the government of Puerto Rico managed to devise several mechanisms to go around that disposition, to violate that disposition. So to begin with, there's probably much of this debt which was issued in violation of the Constitution, and that would certainly be grounds for annulling some of these debts. In the same fashion, recently it was revealed some of the debt of the Puerto Rico Electrical Company, which is a public corporation, it's debt that was issued under the advice of financial advisors who evidently, it seems, knew that this debt could not be paid, that there were no funds to pay for this debt, yet they advised that the government of Puerto Rico issue this debt. And there were all sorts of mechanisms in order to disguise the unpayability of this debt and so on and so forth. So we think that an audit of the debt would reveal portions of the debt of Puerto Rico that are illegal or are that they were adopted violating existing rules, that they are corrupt, and that they are... And as you mentioned, I think there's beyond that, there's a very strong argument that, as I said, the debt is unsustainable in terms of, in human terms. That is to say, as you know, the legal principle is that contracts have to be enforced. But there's also a legal principle which says that a contract that the enforcing of which would imply a violation of human rights and a violation of human dignity cannot be enforced. And there's a very good argument that for Puerto Rico to pay its present debt as it was originally contracted would imply such a violation of human rights.
I just wanted to add to that. I thought it was interesting that it's an international law principle that's been around for centuries and may have played a part in the U.S. position not to incur the debt of Puerto Rico or Cuba after the Spanish-American War. And we should mention that U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders is on record in demanding that if any debt was issued to creditors in violation of Puerto Rico's constitution, that it must be immediately set aside.
Yes, Senator Sanders has taken a very forceful stand in favor of an audit of the debt, which I think is correct. And as you mentioned, that if such an audit would reveal that some parts of the debt are illegal or unconstitutional, it should not be paid. He has also taken a stand against further austerity measures in Puerto Rico in order to pay for this unsustainable debt, which we also agree with. So we think that's the direction in which we should go. I mean, I would hope that there would be other congressmen that would have the position of Senator Sanders. Unfortunately, that's not the case.
And
most of them do not have
left,
that approach.
The minute we have left, what has Hillary Clinton, candidate Clinton, been saying?
She has a far more timid view of the situation in Puerto Rico. I would say that largely her position has been that Puerto Rico should be granted the power to declare bankruptcy under Chapter 9 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. Puerto Rico finds itself in a very strange situation because municipalities in the U.S. and U.S. Public corporations, you know, like the city of Detroit, for example, can declare bankruptcy, can go to bankruptcy court under Chapter 9 of the U.S. bankruptcy law. And that is a framework which works, you know, may or may not work depending on how you work with it, but it is a framework for renegotiating the debt in a way. Puerto Rico cannot use Chapter 9. It's not extended to Puerto Rico, so it doesn't have this framework for renegotiating the debt in an organized way. And so she has been in favor of extending Chapter 9 to Puerto Rico so that it would be able to renegotiate its debt, so to speak, within that framework. That has been the center of her position, which is a demand that the government of Puerto Rico has formulated. So she kind of supports this demand of the government of Puerto Rico.
Finally, I must say that while we're concerned about Senator Sanders and Senator Clinton on these issues, your own position is it pretty much that there must be an audit, or are there other planks to the platform as to the fiscal development of the island in the time to come?
Well, on the short and medium term, I think we have to, as you mentioned, we have to suspend payment on this debt. We cannot keep paying this debt. This is going to bring about major legal battles, and we should have to, you know, we will face them. I think we have to demand from Congress that it approve legislation that protects Puerto Rico against litigation from the creditors when they do suspend payments, you know, some sort of stay on legal actions against the government of Puerto Rico. That would be a good thing. I think we should demand that. We should have an audit of the debt in order to find out what part of the debt is legitimate and which part of it is not legitimate. I think we have to mobilize in Puerto Rico, and we have to mobilize in the United States, in the White House, in Congress, in front of the federal courts if necessary, in front of the offices of the major creditors, in order to demand that Puerto Rico be allowed to reconstruct its economy. I think that the government of Puerto Rico has to revise its tax policies. As I said, there's $35 billion in profits that leave the island every year, and they tax, at best, they pay a tax of about 3 or 4% on those profits. And that has to be reevaluated. They have to pay a little bit more tax in Puerto Rico, particularly in the present situation. So there are many things that have to be done in order to reconstruct Puerto Rico's economy. What the road should not be is to keep imposing austerity measures on the Puerto Rican people in order to pay for a debt which is unsustainable, that will only increase poverty and injustice in Puerto Rico, and it's going to perpetuate the crisis. It's not going to bring Puerto Rico out of the crisis.
And we'd like to thank Professor Barnabe for setting the record straight on this most important issue. And we've been speaking with candidate for governor of Puerto Rico, Professor Rafael Barnabe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
The idea that drag is transphobic fancy dress is complete nonsense. And we've always felt there's a singular profundity in that expression, you know, you're born naked and the rest is drag.
We identify with and connect with outsiders because we grew up as outsiders. That's what all of our work is about. Show me what you got.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Pressure builds in Uganda for a revived Anti-Homosexuality Act. Two U.S. states are deemed dangerous for queer U.K. travelers. And drag artists and other outsiders orbit the world of wonder. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 23rd, 2016. The Speaker of Uganda's Parliament wants to renew what the online Ugandan Insider called her war on homosexuals. The Anti-Homosexuality Act was originally passed in December 2013, punishing private, consensual, adult gay sex with up to life in prison. Speaker Rebecca Kadaga described it as a Christmas gift to the nation. President Yoweri Museveni, who routinely railed against gay people, enthusiastically signed it. But Uganda's highest court overturned the law less than a year later because Kadaga didn't have a quorum when lawmakers passed the bill. The Constitutional Court blamed her directly, writing that the illegal act of the speaker tainted the process and rendered it a nullity. Kadaga told a national political talk show this week that she's encouraging supporters of the resurrected Anti-Homosexuality Act to push for its passage in Parliament. President Museveni, who first gained power in 1986, once said that reviving the bill was not a priority after the original measure suffered widespread international condemnation and threatened loss of vital Western financial aid. But Museveni was re-elected in February, and some human rights activists fear that he may be emboldened to renew his vicious attacks against the LGBT community, thereby stoking an already incendiary situation for sexual minorities in the East African country.
An ultra-Orthodox Jew was convicted this week in Israel for stabbing 16-year-old Shira Banky to death and attempting to murder six others at last year's Jerusalem LGBT Pride Parade. Yeshai Schlissel had been released from prison just 3 weeks before last July's parade after serving a 10-year attempted murder sentence for his knife attack on three Jerusalem Pride marchers in 2005. The Jerusalem District Court was highly critical of police officials for not being able to stop Schlissel, even though he publicly threatened to attack Pride marchers again. The court called the lapse unconscionable. Six senior police officials were removed from their posts because of those failures. A psychiatric evaluation of Schlissel found him responsible for his actions and fit to stand trial. Legal proceedings have been complicated, however, because he continues to refuse counsel and says he doesn't accept the legitimacy of the court. The judge announced the convictions on April 19th and scheduled the sentencing hearings for June 16th, but he already noted the absurdity of Schlissel ever being let out of prison without any supervision.
Some of its more vocal users threatened to abandon the Australian telecom giant Telstra last week because the company had apparently bowed to pressure from the Roman Catholic Church and said it was ending its vocal support for civil marriage equality. The Archdiocese of Sydney had written to many of more than 800 national and international businesses to question their endorsement of the advocacy group Australian Marriage Equality. But Telstra is now once again publicly promoting equality. CEO Andy Penn told national broadcaster SBS on April 18th that, "Last week we announced that we would not add further to the debate on marriage equality ahead of a plebiscite or parliamentary debate. It is clear," he said, "that rather than Telstra stepping back, we should in fact step forward and support our view for marriage equality, and so that is what we will do." Telstra's main rivals, Optus and Vodafone, also support civil marriage equality. So the church's veiled message to Telstra that it might take its substantial business elsewhere seemed like an empty threat. But, Penn added, "by renewing our active position, we acknowledge that we are at equal risk of inflaming a new debate, but it is the right thing to do."
Guidelines published by the British Foreign Office this week caution UK LGBT citizens traveling to North Carolina and Mississippi to keep a low profile because of those U.S. states' recently enacted anti-LGBT laws. The advisory joins Foreign Office warnings to British LGBT people about visiting Russia, Turkey, or predominantly Muslim countries for similar reasons. The new U.S. travel guidelines warn that laws vary from state to state. When you are physically present in a state, even temporarily, you are subject to that state's laws. Barack Obama happened to be visiting Britain this week, probably his last official visit as president. He called for the discriminatory laws to be overturned, but assured queer Brits that they'd be safe in those two states.
"I want everybody here in the United Kingdom to know that the people of North Carolina and Mississippi are wonderful people. They are hospitable people. They are beautiful states. And you are welcome. And you should come and enjoy yourself. And I think you'll be treated with extraordinary hospitality. I also think that the laws that have been passed there are wrong. And although I respect their different viewpoints, I think it's very important for us not to send signals that anybody is treated differently."
In other news, a major U.S. federal appeals court ruling affirming the rights of a transgender student in Virginia is expected to have a direct impact on bathroom bills in other states, including North Carolina's. Those laws require trans people to use public restrooms, locker rooms, and other sex-segregated facilities that match their birth gender, even if their gender identity is different. Female-to-male Virginia teen Gavin Grimm sued his school board after he was ordered to use a campus restroom that corresponded to his biological gender. Even before he began treatment for gender dysphoria, the lawsuit charged, girls and women who encountered Gavin in female restrooms reacted negatively because they perceived Gavin to be a boy. The Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 on April 19th that the order against Gavin violated Title IX of the Education Act of 1972, which bans bias based on sex, and ordered a lower court that had ruled differently to re-examine the case. Any legal challenge to North Carolina's HB2 would also be heard by the Fourth Circuit, so its decision in the Virginia transgender teen case could also spell the death of the anti-trans law in the Tar Heel State. The sponsor of Tennessee's bathroom bill temporarily pulled her proposal from consideration this week for what she called further study.
The National Basketball Association continues to pressure North Carolina lawmakers to take another look at HB2, warning this week that next year's NBA All-Star Game will be moved out of Charlotte if the law isn't changed. The News and Observer reports that HB2 has already cost the state millions of tourism dollars and, according to the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, some $28 million in future spending is at stake. Boston, Pearl Jam, and Duran Duran joined the growing list of entertainers this week to either cancel gigs in North Carolina or donate the proceeds of their shows to local LGBT advocacy groups. And the Daily Beast reports that calls to transgender suicide hotlines have more than doubled since Republican Governor Pat McCrory signed HB2 into law March 24th. The latest polls show the seemingly clueless McCrory, who continues to defend the law, losing his re-election bid in November to current Attorney General Roy Cooper, a Democrat. Cooper has said he won't defend the clearly unconstitutional HB2 in court. The Republican-dominated state legislature begins its short session in the coming week. Some observers predict, despite mounting pressure, that they're unlikely to make significant changes to the law.
And finally, Mississippi suffers a growing backlash against its sweeping so-called religious freedom law, HB 1523. It allows people in the private and public sectors to discriminate against LGBT people or any other people they don't like, based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. Go-Go's founder Belinda Carlisle, who said she considered canceling a scheduled concert in Mississippi before using it to speak out against the law, has a gay son.
As a proud mother of a gay son, I can't imagine anything less Christian than using the law as a weapon against others. It is my call as a mother to try to bring a little bit of heaven to Mississippi and compliment the incredible bravery of those who continue to organize and fight here long after I'm gone.
Republican Governor Phil Bryant, meanwhile, belittled Canadian rocker Bryan Adams for canceling his concert in Biloxi because of HB 1523 and continues to falsely claim that the far-reaching anti-LGBT law in Mississippi is no different than laws passed in several other states.
We have one guy from the 1980s that cancels a concert. We all want to talk about that. It is interesting. The media says, you know, y'all ought to be dealing with these important issues and not some issue about someone's deeply held religious belief, not going to take anyone's rights away from them. It simply says the government cannot discriminate against people of faith or religious organizations, which is the same law. If I could get anyone to look at that, I can give you a copy of it. The same law that Governor Cuomo signed into a law in New York in 2011.
Saturday Night Live comic actor Tracy Morgan, who himself once came under fire for insensitive homophobic comments, has canceled a scheduled stand-up performance in Tunica, Mississippi, because of the law. But out-performer and Clinton, Mississippi native Lance Bass was back in his hometown this week helping to plant a community garden. He says he's organizing events in Mississippi, not canceling them. "I learned in church that you always fight hate with love," he said.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 23rd, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out on this station.
In the drag race between Rue and Mini Rue, a short story about the smaller size comes in first.
The RuPaul Doll, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. RuPaul Andre Charles, better known as RuPaul, is an American drag performer, actor, model, and singer-songwriter. Gaining fame in the 1990s on television shows and films, he launched a reality show in 2009 called RuPaul's Drag Race. With popularity comes your own doll, and the RuPaul doll made its debut in 2005. The doll was created by Integrity Toys and designed by Jason Wu, who also designed First Lady Michelle Obama's inaugural ball gown. The box says, 99% plastic, 1% woman. The RuPaul doll comes in many styles, including supermodel RuPaul, red hot RuPaul, and glamazon RuPaul, all with that over-the-top look. Take your pick. They're ready to sashay down the runway. This Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Glenn Lash in Philadelphia.
Inside Deep Throat, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Million Dollar Listing, Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, and The RuPaul Drag Race. They're among the progeny of Hollywood's reality TV and documentary production house, World of Wonder. Our entertainment reporter Steve Pride explores World of Wonder's history and future with its empire-building co-founders.
Dancing in the
Before World of Wonder founders Randy Barbato and Fenton Bailey ran a reality TV empire, they were a disco pop rock duo called the Fabulous Pop-Tarts, performing at clubs in downtown New York City. They formed World of Wonder in 1981 to self-distribute their records and promote the neophyte careers of fabulous friends like RuPaul.
I'm Randy Barbato.
I'm Fenton Bailey. Randy and I met in the East Village in the 80s, and we went to a club called The Pyramid, and we saw these amazing drag shows. And we looked at each other and we were like, this is art. This is incredible. This is great work. This should be seen beyond The Pyramid. The idea that drag is men in dresses, or the idea that drag, to use politically correct terminology, is transphobic fancy dress, is complete nonsense. It is the ultimate creative act of taking the canvas of your body and inventing something rich and strange, not necessarily with a lot of money, but using the power of imagination, because that's what it is. And we've always felt there's a singular profundity in that expression, you know, you're born naked and the rest is drag. We're all in a kind of uniform, and that uniform is, like it or not, a kind of chosen presentation or image. It's all drag. And by drag, I mean true creativity, real imaginative work that it is significant.
Fenton and I, when we met in the 80s in the East Village, back when the East Village was the East Village, we were going to NYU Film School. We used to cut classes to go to the Pyramid happy hour. And truly, we'd quit film school and enrolled at the Pyramid. It really was the turning point for us. And it has been to this day. I mean, so many of the people that we met there now, we're still friendly with. They continue to inspire us. And it makes sense. We identify with and connect with outsiders because we grew up as outsiders. That's what all of our work is about. And it's not only about people who are on the fringe, but it's about that commitment to helping people who don't identify with that understand that actually we're all outsiders. We all, whether it's Mapplethorpe or Tammy Faye or Monica Lewinsky or RuPaul, it's about their humanity. It's about what we have in common with people who we perceive as being other. The reality is they aren't other. They are us. That's who we are. And that's who we have always been. That's who we've always been attracted to. And our life's work has been about sharing those people, those worlds with everybody else and getting other people to understand, actually, you know what? That's who you are.
Your life's work has been so prolific. I went on IMDb this morning thinking I'll just run through these real quick, and they just kept paging down, paging down, paging down.
We work with a lot of people, though. We have a production company called World of Wonder. It's a production company filled with artists, filled with outsiders, filled with people like us who make great things. So we're blessed.
World of Wonder actually did not begin as what it is today. It was to represent the Fabulous Pop-Tarts. And that your relationship with RuPaul goes all the way back to those days.
Our relationship with Ru does go back a long way.
I saw the video for Whore on YouTube.
That was from the Christmas special. Yeah, the Christmas special we did for Channel 4, where the Meatpacking District was still then the Meatpacking District. Yes. And we shot that commercial for RuPaul's Whore, She Who Is.
We've known RuPaul for over 30 years.
We were playing in Atlanta, performing in Atlanta, and Ru introduced us. And I think we knew then that Ru really was the one who belonged on stage.
Yes, we were just like...
rather than us.
We've known from the moment we first saw Ru that, oh my God, every minute he's not on TV is a crime to humanity. He was fully realized.
Absolutely.
30 years ago. He was saying, everybody say love, you're born naked and the rest is drag. Then he was complete, and we could have these kinds of conversations we had with him then. He was spiritual. He had a vision. Yeah. He had a list of the things he wanted to accomplish in his life. Don't you remember when we saw him in Atlanta and he was wheat posting posters that said, RuPaul is everything? It was like, oh my God.
Oh my God, yes. Randy and I just looked at each other and was like, that mother's a star. We really did feel that he was a star. And it was just a question of the rest of the world catching up. And ultimately, we think it's a really good thing because we are in an age when, with the rise of Donald Trump, with the refugee crisis, with terrorism, we need to keep open hearts and open minds. There's a lot of messaging out there to close down and to shut people out, but that is not the way forward. And I just think that someone like Rue and the 100-plus drag queens now that have been on Drag Race, you know, they really help us to open our hearts and open our minds. And the work of Robert Mapplethorpe and, you know, the incredible artistry of Big Frida and even, you know, Frederick and Ryan from Million Dollar Listings. The great thing is these are all characters who live their life out loud. You don't have to be gay, but who just without apology, without shame, have the courage to be themselves and not let other people's ideas silence them or not edit themselves to accommodate themselves to this false idea of normality. Because as Randy said, normality doesn't exist. We're all ultimately a minority of one. So everyone's a little bit gay.
When people start talking down on reality television, it always makes you think that's not one thing. There are several kinds of reality television. There's several levels of quality and integrity.
And really, ultimately, all of it, reality scripted, unscripted, competition elimination, whatever you want to call it, it's really all storytelling.
We don't like to trash other TV, but I do think our stuff is stuff we're attracted to. So there's some things out there we're never going to make because we're not attracted to it. We're not really into violence, so we're not going to make table-tossing shows. We and the people who we work with just work on stuff we're passionate about. So there's some stuff out there that I don't particularly like, and I know we're never going to be doing that stuff because we're not passionate about it. Life's too short.
Two queens stand before me. Ladies, this is your last chance to impress me and save yourself from elimination. The time has come for you to lip sync for your life.
Do you think the show has changed drag?
I think that the show hasn't changed drag. I think it has created more opportunity. I mean, the interesting thing and the thing that we're completely committed to with Drag Race is there's a winner every season, but everyone's a winner who's on Drag Race. We're committed to just growing drag and growing the art of drag and using Drag Race to create that interest and excitement about this art form. And what's great about this show, and it's unique to it, to all other competition reality shows, is that we have 100 drag queens who have been on that show, and almost all of them have careers now. They get booked. They make money. We have kind of reinvigorated people's interest in drag, which is so important. It's so important, especially now, because drag queens are the Marines of the LGBTQ community. Their high heels are the boots. They have fought for the cause from day one. They threw the brick at Stonewall. They don't get the respect they deserve. And this show, yes, it's a TV show and it's entertainment and there's fun and there's joy, but it is political. We do believe for so long that these artists have gone unrecognized. And it's great that it's had the life that it's had, and knock wood, it will continue, because the longer it's on, the broader it can be, the more types of queens we can include. You know, we have pageant queens, comedy queens, fishy queens. We're growing it to represent all the different types of artists who are in drag. And by the way, now we also have DragCon, which this year will be the second year, May 4th at the Los Angeles Convention Center. Last year, there were 14,000 people at DragCon. There were families, children, all kinds of drag queens. And this year, it's going to be double the size. So we've really tapped into a tribe of people out there, people who love drag, people who do drag. And our commitment is to make it as inclusive as possible. And, you know, it's hard. It's challenging because we can only have like 10 queens a year on. And it's funny, after the first couple seasons, people are like, well, you're going to run out of drag queens. Uh-uh. No, we aren't, because there's a whole new generation of young drag queens. Plus, the older drag queens now are understanding it's okay to be on Drag Race.
So Drag Race is really a platform or a stage. I suppose you could say that traditionally TV has been drag queen resistant. Drag queens belong on TV, no question. The small screen is perfect for the big visuals and the big hats. It's just perfect medium.
First came Drag Race, then DragCon. The next thing for us is drag TV. I mean, we want a network just filled with drag queens.
You have a YouTube channel now, correct?
Yes. Wow Presents, where a number of the girls, like Alyssa Edwards, there are a number of queens who have shows on Wow Presents.
What is the best part of being you?
Wow. Well, I guess the best part is it doesn't feel like work. Yeah, sure, it's hard work. But it's really more fun and enjoyable. And we really do love what we do and feel really lucky to be able to do it. And I think that's the best part.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it gets challenging when you're making TV and when you're dealing with people who are attracted to the lights. Sometimes they get it twisted and they forget that there's actually room for everyone at the table. So that can be challenging. But when that's not part of the equation, when people get – I love it when people get what we're doing, that we're just trying to bring more people to the table. DragCon is such – like that's a great thing. That's one of the best things that we – what's the best thing – about being you is getting to do something like DragCon, because it's the total manifestation of everything we're about. And everyone gets to participate in the different ways that you want to. Like, there's enough room for everyone. You know, there are a few queens who like it's never big enough, it's never enough. But increasingly, I think people get that that's what we're about. And that's really rewarding.
This has been a conversation with World of Wonder founders Randy Barbato and Fintan Bailey. Find more information at worldofwonder.net. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Carol Myers, Glenn Lash, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Steve Pride, produced by Steve Pride, contributed program material. RuPaul performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, WRNC Ashland, Wisconsin, 4ZZZ Brisbane, Queensland, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. To say that someone is a worker isn't terribly descriptive, since the vast majority of us work, and there are a great variety of things people do. But generalizations abound about what workers are going through or how their lives are being affected by this or that. That's not surprising. Generalizations often drive analysis and advocacy, not to mention official policy. Today we look at a claim that seems to be gaining steam, that the line between work and the rest of life is getting increasingly blurred. That, for example, our work days no longer end when we go home because of laptops and other devices. It's an interesting argument, and one that many professionals can relate to. So why have two scholars come forward to confront it? Barbara Ellen Smith and Jamie Winders, in a chapter they co-wrote for a new book called Precarious Worlds, argue that for many people, the line between work and life is in fact getting more defined. In the face of economic insecurity, neoliberal attacks on public institutions, and the targeting of immigrants. Barbara Ellen Smith is professor of women's and gender studies in the sociology department at Virginia Tech, and she co-edited the volume Transforming Places, Lessons from Appalachia. Jamie Winders is associate professor of geography at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University, and she's the author of Nashville in the New Millennium, Immigrant Settlement, Urban Transformation, and Social Belonging. I spoke recently with Jamie Winders in studio and Barbara Ellen Smith by phone, and I began by asking Jamie to lay out the claim that she and Barbara Ellen take issue with.
For the last 10 or 15 years, feminist geographers and a lot of people who kind of do research related to the nature of work have tried to get their heads around how the work process or the labor process is changing, particularly for people kind of associated with knowledge production. And the classic example are academics. So things like your smartphone and having internet access at home and always being available really blur the lines between when you're at work and when you're not at work. I always describe that process to my graduate students. It's like low intensity warfare. You're never not working. It's kind of always there. And so there's no, for many academics, there's sort of no clear line between being at work and being at home or not working. And that model we see in other kinds of industries, especially ones that are sort of facilitated by technology, where the argument is that life implodes into work and work kind of becomes the only sphere. And in the process, we and kind of that group of workers are increasingly defined by what we're doing. We're interpolated as subjects based on the kinds of work that we do. It comes to define who we are.
And is it your sense that people who are presenting these kinds of arguments are generalizing the situation to all workers or most workers in the neoliberal economy?
I think that's happening to some extent. And you see it in particular in, especially in the global north, in a push toward what used to be talked about in terms of a work-life balance is now often talked about in terms of policies of work-life integration. And again, the idea is that work can be done anywhere, at any time. It's not contained in a particular workplace. It's not bounded by a start and a stop time. And so instead of trying to maintain that line between work and home, the idea is that at a lot of high-skill, high-wage work sites like Google and some of the Silicon Valley places, there's a real attempt to integrate life into work.
So, Barbara Ellen, is the notion that the boundaries between work and home are blurry, is this a new notion or argument?
Well, feminists have long pointed to the fact that, first of all, women typically, although men in some cases as well, work at home, right? Not only for, of course, pay, but also doing all kinds of unpaid labor to keep households going and families going, children fed and so on. And also have argued that we can make too much of the distinction between work and home in situations where, for example, women have done craft work at home in order to supplement their incomes or engaged in other kinds of productive, meaning income-producing activities at home. So there has been blurring, but what we see today is something that's much more clearly a kind of spatial blurring of what is work and what is the rest of life. We can work all the time, anywhere, always be available to labor, and that's really different.
And key to both of your analysis is a distinction made not just between work and, quote, home, but between production, which I think means, in the way you're using it, waged labor, paid work, and what's called social reproduction. Could one of you define what social reproduction means? And I understand, actually, from your writings that there are a lot of meanings assigned to the phrase, but maybe what's a working definition for how we'll be talking about it this hour?
So when I think about social reproduction on a basic level, I think about all of the kind of labor and effort that goes into reproducing us as workers on a daily basis, as well as cultural beings. So it's all the kind of components of daily life that sustain us individually, that sustain us across generations, and that kind of enable us as a species to continue going. And so everything from child rearing and meal preparation to education to all of the kind of informal learning that goes along with socializing us into particular classed and racialized and gendered positions. And, you know, that's, some people sort of refer to it as almost the stuff of life or of all of the kind of things that go into maintaining life itself.
And by reproducing workers on a daily basis, so we're not talking about, like, in that case, reproduction, making new human beings. We're talking about, what, maintaining them such that they can go out and work the next day?
I think it's both. It works on an individual and it works on a generational scale. So it's you know, if you think about the kind of classic model of the factory worker, which was the basis for a lot of the early kind of theorizations around social reproduction, It's when that factory worker leaves the factory, what are all of the tasks and things that have to happen in order for him, and it's deeply gendered, to kind of return to the factory the next day, and for his family to continue, and for there to continue to be a worker able to go to that workplace across generations. So it's the very material labor that goes into maintaining the household, of consumption practices, and it's also kind of the ideological work that keeps that system going.
So what's the relationship between social reproduction, this notion, and Marxism, feminism, the sort of the Marxist-feminist theoretical tradition? Because I guess you could say, well, you know, Marxism interested in labor and capital, workers and employers, and so what you're saying about social reproduction being part of making sure that workers are available for capitalist production and capitalist markets seems to hook in to at least the Marxist tradition pretty well there.
That's correct. Marxist feminists early on, and I'm talking about 19th century, not just the 1960s, 70s, pointed to all of the labor that was required to reproduce labor power or the capacity to work. And that included not only biological reproduction, but also the labor of taking care of workers in the household, reproducing labor intergenerationally, and taking care of disabled workers as well. But the key, of course, in terms of the Marxist interest is in labor itself, albeit with a blind spot around all of the work that went into replenishing labor or labor power and the capacity to work, which, of course, is where the feminists came in with strong arguments about all the unpaid and invisible labor that traditionally women have done.
So we're going to get into some specific case studies that illustrate or support or reinforce an argument you're trying to make. But let me ask you to encapsulate that argument from at the beginning. Do you agree with this argument that the line between work and the rest of life, between production and what's sometimes called social reproduction, is blurring, is dissolving?
We argue that that's the case with a certain class of workers, particularly knowledge workers and those who are able to perform their work using primarily digital communication technologies that overcome the constraints of distance and space. But we also argue that there's a class specificity to that. We're talking about primarily more elite, professionally trained workers, highly educated workers, as distinct from many workers who still labor in very physically delimited spaces. They go to work. They go to a factory. They go to Starbucks to work. They go to Walmart to work. Their work is not disembodied or facilitated by digital technology in the same way that it is for knowledge workers or workers on the higher end of the spectrum of the labor force.
Is it your sense that this focus on, you know, knowledge work, intellectual work, academic work, that theorists are going there partly because, you know, it's kind of sexy, right? I mean, they're thinking about kind of the new economy, new technologies, and new ways of doing things, the flexibility of being able to do things not in just one location anymore. Do you think that's part of why theories have tended to harp on this issue of, you know, college professors now being able to do work anywhere, and so that's how we should start thinking of labor more generally?
You know, I think this is a really good question, and I kind of suspect that one of the motivating factors in these arguments about the kind of blurring of the line is the sort of political project of trying to move away from this binary of life and work or social reproduction and production, in which production is always valorized. It's always the starting point. It's always the thing that shapes how we understand or how we think about every other aspect of our lives. So there's a political project associated with these arguments about the dissolving of that line and the implosion of that kind of initial idea of separate spheres. But it's also it's a model that resonates with the lived realities of a lot of people who are making these arguments. And so, you know, when I remember when I first read some of these arguments, thinking, yes, that is exactly my lived reality, where work seeps into life and there's this constant negotiation of when I'm watching a basketball game on television and I'm checking my email and I'm responding to a student, am I at work? Am I at home? Is this production? Is this social reproduction? But then both Barbara and I were doing on-the-ground ethnographic work in other communities and just looking at very different labor processes and very different lived realities, that kind of thinking about what kinds of politics can come out of the line between production and social reproduction if you are working in a chicken factory or if you're a coal miner or if you clean hotel rooms. It's radically different from this kind of argument about we're all life's workers.
That's Jamie Winders. She teaches geography at Syracuse University. Barbara Ellen Smith also joins me. She's a professor of sociology at Virginia Tech. And these two scholars collaborated on an article. It's called Whose Lives, Which Work? Class Discrepancies in Life's Work. In a new volume, it's called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. We have a link to that book and to the faculty pages of my two guests on our website, againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So let's get into the first of the case studies that you present in this paper about kind of challenging this argument that, hey, work and the rest of life is, you know, they're kind of becoming one. And that is what's happened to work in the South and what was called the New South. And I want to start with you, Barbara Ellen. So for some historical context, what happened in the American South after the Civil War in terms of political and economic elites attempting to expand industrial production in the South?
It was a very determined, orchestrated effort to create the so-called New South based on light, low-wage manufacturing. We're talking about a textile industry, especially furniture, and some agricultural processing industries, but particularly textiles. That was really the premier industry of the New South. And the period of time here is the late 19th century and early 20th century. The workers who were drawn into this process tended to be rural, coming off of failing farms, often people who did not own property. There is a long history of poor white Southerners who were part of course, the history of the South. And it was that labor force that was mobilized into the often company towns of the textile industry and other industries at that time.
And so company towns were established by employers to house their workers?
Yes, to house their workers, to educate children. Company towns were established by companies like Fieldcrest Cannon or its predecessors to not only house workers, but really to create the entire infrastructure, the entire social infrastructure necessary, churches, schools, and so forth. So they were very, those activities were very densely concentrated around the mill.
And how long did this pattern and these spatial patterns of labor in the South, how long did they last, and what happened to change things in any significant way?
By the 1980s or so, we began to see the deindustrialization of the rural South insofar as the primary attraction of the South was low-wage, non-union labor. Companies increasingly, of course, found that labor far cheaper in other locations outside of the United States. So that was part of the trend, just the relocation, the offshoring of this production. But we also saw automation such that, again, the consequence was unemployment for textile workers. But we do still have some textile production in the South, as well as furniture, and actually an increase in certain other lower-wage industries like poultry processing.
And in this article, in this book, Precarious Worlds, you cite the example of layoffs and work reductions at a company in North Carolina in the 1980s, and what happened to the lives of people who now no longer worked together in one place at the mills. Talk about that.
What we find is that many companies have, to the extent that they've remained in the South, they have relocated to more urban and proximate suburban areas. And so people who used to work in a textile mill, for example, that was right down the street, now commute on the interstate an hour to work in a mill or in Walmart or in another facility, and are not necessarily by any means commuting in the same direction as their neighbors or their spouses. So people are much more disaggregated, even if they still live in the same community. Their work lives spread in all kinds of directions. So spatially, it's a much more sprawling kind of geography of labor. But in addition to that, of course, the local school, the local church, the many other facilities of the company town, and I don't want to romanticize it because this was also a repressive and paternalistic environment, but spatially with phenomena like school consolidation and with the irregular shifts and often very long shifts that workers are working, the activities both of work itself and then also on the home front of social reproduction become much more fraught in terms of the time available and the predictability of those work efforts.
Can you talk a little bit more about just this focus on geography, which, you know, because a lot of people might not think about the material consequences on people of changing employment patterns. They might not include kind of geographical consequences of, as you said, spending more time on the highway or going in different directions. What you are implying is these phenomena, these criteria really matter to people's lives. It affects what? The way, not just that they live, but the way maybe they think?
Absolutely. It certainly affects how they are able to relate to one another and how they are able to maintain themselves even as a family. If, for example, you are working an unpredictable schedule at Walmart, and in many retail industries and in places like Starbucks, in restaurants and food services, to some extent in hotels, the work schedule is quite flexible, but not determined by the employee. It's very common for a worker not to know what kind of schedule he or she will be working from one week to the next. If you are a parent with children and need to maintain some, hopefully, regularity in terms of your presence in your household, that can be extremely difficult, if not impossible, with those kinds of work schedules. And when you combine that with the fact that people are driving in different directions to get to work and thus spending having much less time available to spend at home, then you can see why there are tensions between the demands of work, particularly when they're unpredictable and irregular, and the needs of social reproduction of children, for example, of child care, of helping kids with homework, of getting meals on the table, of doing your grocery shopping and all of the daily activities of life.
And just to jump in, I think this is a key difference between kind of that model that we started with of the two spheres of your life kind of imploding, and what Barbara is talking about, because under the model where work and life are becoming one, you as the worker, you manage that flexibility. I can check my email anywhere. I can respond to students anywhere. I can download papers to review. I can work in my hotel room. I can do that. If you're working in Walmart, you're working at Starbucks, you're working as a hotel room cleaner, and you have a constantly changing schedule, that is a flexibility forced upon you. You don't have any ability to manage it. If that flexibility is also combined with longer trips to work and your kids have to go a greater distance on the bus to school, which means PTA meetings take longer for you to get there. Maybe the local grocery stores have closed down, so you have to go to the next town to buy food, to get clothes for yourself and your children. You're doing all of those kinds of stretched geographies at the same time that you can't predict your work schedule. And so that flexibility looks radically different at different ends of the class spectrum.
How integral to kind of the new neoliberal economy and the neoliberal way of doing things is just-in-time production and sort of on-demand labor and, you know, the labor that needs to be available in a different way, perhaps, than it used to be available.
I think it's central to the neoliberal economy in the sense that the presumption is that the subject, the worker, exists only to work. There is no consideration given to the fact that this person also needs to maintain herself, have a life, as we say, outside of work. There's no consideration given to that at all. And so the presumption is that you are there just to facilitate your own survival. And one of the things that I think is important is that we've talked about the new technologies, digital communication technologies and so forth, and the ways that knowledge workers use those to enable themselves to work anywhere, anytime, everywhere, all the time. Those technologies are also at stake, but in a very different way, for workers at the bottom end of the class spectrum, in the sense that they are being used to communicate with the worker to tell her, you need to get to work right now. We've got, you know, a press. The market is demanding your presence, in effect. And in some contexts, for example, I've done some research on the distribution sector in Memphis, where there are sprawling warehouses, because Memphis is the hub for FedEx, the global hub for FedEx, and the Memphis International Airport handles more metric tons of cargo than any other airport in the world. As a result of that transportation infrastructure, there are all kinds of warehouses that sprawl along the Tennessee-Mississippi border, in which workers are mobilized to work at the last minute when a certain product becomes in high demand. And so the physical labor is still necessary. The worker is called to that work on a cell phone or whatever device. But the employer also is aware of the market demand, and this is also, of course, part of the neoliberal economy, aware of market demand because those employers are plugged into their global supply chains, and they know that this product is needed right now, and so we need the labor right now in order to fulfill that market demand.
Barbara Ellen Smith and Jamie Winders join me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara teaches women's and gender studies at Virginia Tech, and Jamie teaches geography at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. And again, their essay, their very interesting essay about work, about the rest of life, and about class discrepancies in the way people go about their work and the way their lives maybe ought to be analyzed is part of a new volume. It's called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. It's edited by Katie Meehan and Kendra Strauss, published by the University of Georgia Press. We'll take a short break and speak more with Barbara Ellen and Jamie. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jamie Winders is Associate Professor of Geography at Syracuse University. She's also the author of Nashville in the New Millennium, Immigrant Settlement, Urban Transformation, and Social Belonging. Barbara Ellen Smith is Professor of Women's and Gender Studies in the Department of Sociology at Virginia Tech. She's author of Digging Our Own Graves, Coal Miners and the Struggle Over Black Lung Disease. And we are talking about an article they collaborated on in the new volume, Precarious Worlds. I know both of you have been looking at and studying the lived reality of Latino immigration, Latino immigrants in the U.S. South. Jamie, you write that beginning in the 1990s, Latino immigrants moved to and settled in large numbers in the South. What drew them there?
I think there are a range of factors. There were obviously, at that time in particular, push factors coming out of various parts of Latin America. You had kind of cooling economies in Texas and California. You also had kind of growing anti-immigrant sentiment, particularly in parts of California in the late 90s. You also had a group of about 4.5 million Mexican immigrants in particular whose status was regularized through the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, who now had a new form of spatial mobility, who found it easier to move across the country to go where jobs were more available rather than staying in large cities in Southern California and in Texas where there were kind of large ethnic economies. At the same time, especially in southern cities, local labor markets were booming. There was a really strong desire for kind of low-wage labor in the growing service economies that southern cities were seeing. In the rural South, we also were seeing a reconfiguration of the geography of meat processing and the movement, the kind of consolidation of meat processing into a handful of corporations and the expansion of the number of processing plants and chicken farms. And so in both the rural South and the urban South, you had this need for low-wage labor. We also saw a lot of suburban construction around larger southern cities, and so you had some international factors. You had some political factors in terms of the regularization of immigrant status. You also had economic pull factors. And, you know, in a lot of the work I've done with Latino immigrants in the South about why they came to places like Nashville, Tennessee, or why they moved to Atlanta, it was also a desire for a, quote, safer, more laid-back, more relaxed place to raise children, at least initially. And there's been some interesting research by folks like Steve Strifler and Helen Morrow in immigrant settlement in the rural South that has shown that it was easier for Latino immigrants who settled in rural parts of the American South to kind of approximate a middle-class lifestyle in a way that they simply couldn't in Southern California, where the cost of living are so high.
And yet, is it fair to say that many of these jobs made available to these immigrants were low-wage, such that, you know, even with maybe a lower cost of living, it was still very difficult to get by?
I think so. And that became particularly true when the Great Recession hit. I mean, we know that across the nation, Hispanics or Latinos were the hardest hit in the recession. Some of the industries that were hardest hit in the Great Recession, like construction, were also strongly associated with immigrant labor. And then you add on to that around the same time, sort of beginning in 2006, across the South, you see growing anti-immigrant sentiment. So not only is life more difficult economically, life becomes all but unbearable socially and politically in a lot of these communities, with state and local ordinances really targeting immigrant lives.
So give us some examples of anti-immigration legislation on the federal and the state levels that really made it hard for immigrants to survive, to exist, and I guess bringing in the geography here, maybe even to leave their homes.
One of the things that we started to see kind of in late 2005, but it really picked up in 2006 in the South, is a kind of a sea change in the political climate for immigration. So when I started studying immigrant settlement in the U.S. South in the early 2000s, there was a real sense that maybe we were seeing a different dynamic. People were talking about a new form of Southern hospitality, of immigrant workers being welcome to these communities. That sentiment changed very quickly in kind of 2006. And one of the things that it correlated with was the sort of shift from seeing immigrants in southern cities and small towns as people here to work long hours for low wages and then be invisible to immigrants as my next door neighbor, as residents. It's when that first cohort of immigrant children, the second generation, gets into kindergarten. And this is really how Barbara and I started thinking about these sites of social reproduction, which became so central to this changing kind of political climate. They also, these sites of social reproduction became the spaces and the institutions that were often targeted in these state level and local ordinances, kind of anti-immigrant legislation, of starting to track legal status of children and their parents in public schools, of making it illegal to rent a house to someone who was undocumented. In places like Alabama, the push to make it illegal for the state to enter into a contract with someone who is undocumented, which means you can't get your water hooked up to your house or your trailer, of going after driver's licenses. So some southern states early on, if you were undocumented, you could get a driving certificate, eliminating that. There was talk of in the mid-2000s in places like Georgia of trying to tax remittances as kind of leaked revenue of money that is going somewhere else that should come back to the states. A lot of southern communities, cities, and also counties signed 287G agreements. That program is no longer in practice, but it basically allowed local police officers to act as federal immigration agents. So it conflated local policing with sort of the federal border policing, which created all sorts of fear across immigrant communities. And so one of the things we really saw in the late 2000s is the ability to have a public life as an immigrant, especially an undocumented immigrant, just disappeared. So public spaces were no longer used. And so kind of life really pulled in at the same time that job opportunities were drying up. And so the ability to go to work became incredibly precarious. The ability to take children to school became incredibly precarious. You know, there are lots of stories of immigrants taking back roads, trying to avoid being seen. You know, and so in that context, just the ability to either live or to work becomes dangerous.
And added to that, there were some very highly publicized raids by federal immigration authorities on workplaces and other places, right?
There were. They certainly weren't only in the American South, but I think the largest raid was in North Carolina. You know, one of the things that happened is immigrant settlement in the American South really became visible as a public issue post 9/11. And so it brought concerns about the border and concerns about national security into these just beginning conversations about what it means to have a large foreign-born population in places like rural Alabama or rural Georgia or rural Mississippi. And so one of the things that Barbara and I saw in a lot of our work is the conflation of my neighborhood is changing, and this is a threat to my nation. So, again, the sites of social reproduction became so central to the ways that this anti-immigrant sentiment unfolded.
And you've begun to answer this, but what do you conclude from what you've just said and what you've observed in the U.S. South about the degree to which, again, we get back to this argument that the distinction between work and home, between work and the rest of life is getting blurry, it's getting fluid. What do you conclude, at least about these kinds of workers, what do you conclude about the validity of that argument?
The line seems to be not blurring, but if anything, hardening. The only context in which it's blurring is when one has no paid work at all. And we do find that, of course, in many areas. But the idea that one can work and take care of the rest of life simultaneously, multitasking at home, anywhere, everywhere, all the time, is simply not the case.
It's hardening, and it also is increasingly difficult to maneuver. And I think that's a key distinction. So when I go back to my hotel room, it will be very easy for me to slip between work and play or work and life. I can move across that at will. What we see across the U.S. South in these different kind of working class communities is it's not only sharpening and hardening, it's just increasingly difficult to negotiate.
That's the voice of Jamie Winders. She's an associate professor of geography at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Also joining us by phone is Barbara Ellen Smith. She's professor of women's and gender studies in the Department of Sociology at Virginia Tech. And again, these two women, these two scholars have co-authored an article. It's called Whose Lives, Which Work? Class Discrepancies, with the emphasis on class, in Life's work, and it's part of a new volume called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And I want to go to the kind of the third case study that the two of you present in this new volume, Precarious Worlds, and that is the coal fields of rural Appalachia, which includes southern West Virginia, which, according to your paper, has eight major coal-producing counties. And Barbara Ellen, you were talking earlier about company towns in the, quote, New South. They were company towns also in Appalachia, right?
That's correct, but one of the huge differences among many between those in the so-called coal fields of places like southern West Virginia and the company textile towns in places like North Carolina is that in West Virginia and other parts of the central Appalachian coal fields, the labor movement was extremely strong. The area was solidly unionized during the 1930s, so that you had not so much this paternalistic kind of company town situation where workers were very much at the mercy of employers and surveilled and so forth, but that workers had their own class, working class space and leverage vis-a-vis the coal industry via the United Mine Workers of America.
And Jamie was just talking about the closing down of public spaces under threat and under attack in many areas where in the U.S. South where there are Latino immigrants and Latino immigrant communities. In the coal fields of rural Appalachia, what's happened to public space in the neoliberal era?
We're seeing a dramatic shrinking of public space in the coal fields of central Appalachia, and that's happening through kind of shrinking of state support for various activities of daily life, including public schools. So school consolidation has proceeded apace, meaning that communities that once had an elementary school, a middle school, and perhaps a high school in the adjacent community no longer have any of those schools. Students have to ride a bus sometimes for an hour or more each way in order to get to the school. It's so distant, of course, that parents have difficulty getting there for any kind of after-school meetings with teachers or for kids to engage in after-school activities. Post offices have closed down. About half of the post offices in southern West Virginia have closed in the eight counties that I was investigating. And deunionization, which has been a rapid and determined and violent process spearheaded by A.T. Massey in the 1980s, has, of course, erased the public space of the union hall and the kind of brotherhood, as it indeed was, despite the presence of some union women miners, but the brotherhood of coal miners has really diminished in this context as well. And then finally, with environmental deregulation, we have seen the growth of mountaintop removal, so that literally the physical landscape is disappearing associated with that mining practice, which involves blowing the tops off of mountains and just allowing all of the rubble, trees, vegetation to fall down the side of the mountain and fill up streams. There's a great deal of destruction of watersheds and all kinds of forms of life. The Appalachians are some of the richest, or have been historically, mountains in terms of biodiversity, and that's really disappearing.
I think what Barbara just laid out really helps illustrate again kind of that difference. If the metaphor of understanding kind of the knowledge worker is the blurring of these spheres, what we're seeing in these communities that we're looking at is, as we've already talked about, this stretching of the kind of labor and life geographies, and then, as she just described, really the scouring of the landscape of social reproduction. And some scholars put the environment as a component of social reproduction, and I think in the context of Appalachia, you can literally see how that landscape of of sites of community, of sites of public engagement and public space are being scoured kind of in the same ways that the actual physical landscape of these mountains are being scoured out.
And just for listeners who recently joined us, what do you mean again by social reproduction?
So when we think of social reproduction, we're thinking of all of the kind of work and effort that goes into maintaining us not only as workers, but also as cultural beings on a daily basis, but also from generation to generation, so also the literal reproduction of the next generation of workers. It's basically the reproduction of the social, all the things that kind of keep us going as a species.
In this article, you also look at what are often called family-friendly employment policies, like flex time and telecommuting. So what do you think of such policies and the extent to which they can address labor concerns in light of what you've been telling me this hour?
Those policies are terrific if you're a knowledge worker and you're stressed about the amount of work that you are carrying home with you and you need to be able to create more of a distinction between your home life and your work life, and you need your employer to recognize that you, in fact, have children who need your attention and that you're not available to work 16-hour days and so on. That kind of policy is very desirable, important, and necessary. But for the woman who is working at Walmart and doesn't even know her schedule from week to week, the idea that Walmart is going to engage in family-friendly employment policies is really kind of ludicrous. The greater need there is more hours, more predictable hours, and a higher wage with fringe benefits.
Also, I have a very vivid memory when we were working on, when we were sort of beginning to put these ideas together, of reading about these work-life policies and then reading reports coming out in 2009 and 2010 about the percentage of immigrant workers in the South who simply didn't get paid. So where you have wage theft and, you know, policies for work-life balance would be great there. But what would be really great would be policies that could make sure that they actually got their wages in the first place.
You've also written that kind of the dynamics of precarity and of this mandate to be willing to be available constantly and to go anywhere for work is especially pronounced among Latino construction workers. Can you talk about that sector?
Sure. So in a lot of southern cities, and this is a trend that holds probably across most American cities, a lot of workers in the construction industry tend to be younger Latino men who, especially maybe in the early years of being in the U.S., have families that live elsewhere, maybe live in Mexico, Guatemala, wherever. They're often here by themselves. They're living in apartment complexes where their roommates are all construction workers. And in that moment in the life course, the ability to be that flexible worker who maximizes hours, who works as much as he, it's almost always a he, can, that seems to work. Where we start to see the rub between those demands of being this uber flexible, constantly available worker is when life intervenes. It's when you fall in love and maybe you have a child and maybe you want to have time for a family on the side, but you're also being paid wages that don't enable you to sustain that family. So maybe your partner also has to work and she's also working in low wage labor. And so you both have these different sets of demands. And it's in that moment where you have sort of the place-based demands of life and social reproduction that bump up against these demands for hyper flexibility from immigrant labor that you start to see some of these conflicts.
And Jamie, you referred earlier to all the anti-immigrant legislation and rhetoric, and I just wonder now, with some of the discourse around immigrants, what you think the state and trajectory of that rhetoric is, and whether rhetorical changes or maybe even different legislative approaches might ease some of the burdens on Latino immigrant workers.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I have to say, kind of going into this round of presidential debates and all of those sorts of things. I didn't really anticipate early on that immigration was going to be a significant issue. We're in the last couple of years, there are more Central Americans coming into the U.S. than Mexicans coming into the U.S. The border crossings are at incredibly low levels. And so, you know, if you think about what was the kind of empirical reality of immigration in, say, 2007, when we saw that last round of sort of intense anti-immigrant sentiment, it was a very different reality. But that the fact that there's a that we're looking at a kind of totally different context of immigration hasn't changed the fact that people like Donald Trump has managed to make immigration one of the central issues. But it's interesting because the kind of public discourse around it is much more about criminality now than it was. And so if we look back at what kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, how it was being mobilized, what were the sites that were being discussed, what kinds of actions, it was very much about these sites of daily life, about how my school is changing, my neighborhood is changing. And that wasn't only in the South. It was in places like Hazleton, Pennsylvania. It was very much around these sites of daily life. What we're seeing now is a much more kind of vitriolic, just sweeping stereotypes that don't necessarily link down to any particular places. It's just this rhetoric of hate that isn't grounded in the same way.
So what's your sense of how the insights you've both shared with me this hour and the insights you share in this book, Precarious Worlds, how can they help in terms of devising strategies to help working class people and households in a way that a notion, a theory of, hey, work and home and the division between it is kind of blurring, can't?
I think what our work points to is the need for social movements and social policies that address both the labor issues, and of course these are already happening, the fight for 15, for example, living wage efforts, the fight for paid sick days. You know, professional knowledge workers take for granted that they can take time off if they get really sick. That is not the case for many of the kinds of working class people that we talk about in this chapter. And so on the one hand, there's a need for all kinds of improvements on the labor side, but there's also a need to shore up the side in which people are trying to take care of their children, they're trying to have some kind of family life, and the demands of employers, which are so unpredictable and inflexible in terms of the requirement that you must work overtime, you must be there at a certain time and so on, or you will not have a job, that the needs for people to be supported in their social reproductive activities as well. That is to say, in terms of public education, in terms of the infrastructure of social life, for people who cannot resort to private solutions to social, collective social needs.
I think it also, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen the move from let's talk about work-life balance to let's talk about work-life integration policies. And for some workers in some places with some kinds of work, that can be a very progressive move. But we also have to acknowledge the right to maintain work from life, that under some conditions, what we need to fight for, as Barbara has been talking about, is a distinction. It's not a blurring. It's not about we need policies that can integrate life into work. We need policies that allow workers to have a life. And those policies need to go all the way up to a wider investment in the social. You know, that when you hire a worker, you're not just hiring a worker stripped of social. You're hiring a person who comes with connections to other people and who comes with a life, and that those other parts of our being have to be cared for, and it can't be cared for only by the family.
That's Jamie Winders, Associate Professor of Geography at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. You might want to check out her book, Nashville in the New Millennium. Barbara Ellen Smith joined us by phone from Virginia Tech, where she is a professor of women's and gender studies in the sociology department, and she is author of Digging Our Own Graves, Coal Miners and the Struggle Over Black Lung Disease. And they co-authored an article, although they've collaborated on a number of things over the years, but the article we addressed was called Whose Lives, Which Work? Class Discrepancies in Life's Work, and it's to be found in a volume called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. Barbara Allen, Jamie, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It was our pleasure.
Thank you.
And Barbara Allen is also co-editor of the volume Transforming Places, Lessons from Appalachia. This is CS. Justin, the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find audio resources and a way to sign up for our podcast. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Thank you.